Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, liberty-loving patriots. Welcome to the Lucid Libertarian with Lorianne Show. Please be sure to tune in Sunday nights from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. Pacific Time, 9 to 11 p.m. Eastern, to discuss current events, news, and political opinion with Lucid Libertarian flair. Be prepared, folks. We often go into an optional extended third hour. This show advocates for liberty, freedom, our Constitution, Bill of Rights, and limited government, while speaking against corporate and government corruption, tyranny, and the globalist Great Reset agenda that undermines our precious American sovereignty. Discussions here are unscripted and free-flowing, so sometimes conversations wander off in unpredictable directions. Would you like to call in and share your thoughts and be part of the conversation? The number is 563-999-3698. Again, that is 563-999-3698. Press number 1 and you'll be added to the queue. Please also like and follow my Lucid Libertarian with Lorianne page on Facebook. You can help me battle their freedom-loathing censorship by visiting my page regularly, along with reacting, commenting, and sharing my posts. Thank you so much for listening, but please sit tight and don't go anywhere. We'll be back in a few minutes to kick off the show.
Imagine waking up in a trunk. What is grooming? What if I told you we had a 40% increase of human and sex trafficking in our country due to COVID lockdowns? We already had high numbers to begin with. One's Purpose is an amazing organization pounding the pavement every day, helping these survivors get help. Unfortunately, they do not have the funding they need for a safe house. In the state of Oregon, we have zero safe houses for these survivors who have endured the most heinous of crimes. The time is now to get involved. The time is now to help stop human trafficking. Please go to onespurpose.com to get involved. If you need help and if you know someone who needs to get help, please contact 541-221-3448. Make a donation. Make a difference.
NWCR Radio has been on the air since 2006 and with Conservative Nation Media since 2013. Now, NWCR continues as the owner of CNM with the news that the lamestream lying liberal media chooses not to tell you because the truth has nothing to do with the agenda that they are all pushing. We will tell the truth no matter what the liberal left has to say about it or what the truth is. Being banned off of YouTube for telling the truth with my updates and off of Facebook several times, we have our badges of honor that we keep pushing the envelope for on our show. My co-host, Lucid Libertarian Lorianne, and I, along with my band of callers, have great shows with great information for America on each episode. We are NWCR Radio, Friday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on Blog Talk Radio through Conservative Nation Media, where America always wins.
could beg them what's the use? That's why it's called a moment of truth. Yeah, I get it if you need it. I'll search if you don't see it. You're thirsty, I'll be rain. You get hurt, I'll take your pain. I know you don't believe it, but I said it and I still mean it. When you heard what I told you, when you get worried, I'll be a soldier. The feet get cold. Hide in here, hide in there. Find them underneath the stairs. People hiding everywhere, trying to be still as a stone.
Loving patriots out there, you are tuned in to the Lucid Libertarian with Lori Ann Show. Thank you so much for making your way here tonight. Tonight I have a very special guest, Captain Dan Hanley. He is the director of 911pilots.org or 911 Pilot Whistleblowers, but you can visit the website 911pilots.org. And you can check it out. There's lots of great videos on there with interviews. There's a documentary you should definitely check out there. And so, you know, a lot of great information that he has presented. And he, if you don't know who Captain Dan Hanley is, he has definitely been one of the people that comes to mind when I think of the people out there fighting for 9/11 truth, what really happened on 9/11. He is definitely one of those top people that come to mind. His background is he served in the U.S. Navy, and he also was a pilot for United Airlines for 25 years. So a combination of over 35 years as a pilot, crewed over 20,000 flight hours. And so if there is somebody that understands the capability of the planes and what it takes to fly those planes, the planes that hit the towers, the plane that hit the Pentagon, the Pennsylvania, this guy is one of those people that knows his stuff, right? So he certainly is one of those people that he can attest to the difficulty that it would take near impossibility that it would take to pull off the all of those flights. And we can get into that a little bit later in the show. He, by speaking the truth, he was wrongfully terminated. And we could speak to that as well. He has had a lot of personal sacrifices, a lot of impact on his life just for trying to speak the truth. And so we're going to talk about that as well. And who knows what else? So I really want to welcome this guest. I'm super excited that he is coming on the show. We've had some conversations personally just to get to kind of know each other, but not talk a lot about, you know, stuff that we'll talk about on the show. It was just kind of like, hey, get to know you kind of thing. So this is not a scripted show, y'all. I don't have, like, you know, a Word document open with a bunch of questions that I want to ask them and all that kind of stuff. So it's really going to be kind of a free-for-all, a very flowing conversation. And just for everybody that's out there listening, what I tend to do when I have a guest on the show is I like to have at least an hour one-on-one of free conversation. And then during the second hour, I will bring on callers and try to limit your call. You know, I know that we'll probably have some people raising their hands that are going to want to ask questions or comment on some of the things that he says, which is great. You know, but we don't want to spend, you know, half an hour with one person, right? So, especially if we have multiple people. So we're going to try to manage this the best we can, and we're going to try to take callers as many as we can during that second hour of the show. And so, you know, as we talk and things like that, you know, jot down the questions or comments that you might have as he's speaking, and then we'll open up the phone lines during the second hour. So with that, I am going to go ahead and welcome my very special guest on, firing him up now, Mr. Captain Dan Hanley. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Lori. Thank you for having me on the program and for that kind introduction. I'm glad to be here.
Oh, well, it is my honor, really. You are such a truther, and you've definitely paid the price for telling the truth. So I am very happy that you saw, you know, this all started because you made a post on Facebook about trying to get on, like, with Tucker Carlson and a few others. And then I happened to mention my little show here. and then you were kind enough to go, yeah, sure, okay. And so we kind of threw it together, didn't we?
Yes, we did. If I could, Lorianne, I'll fill in a few details of my flight resume just to try to give myself credibility for what I'm talking about tonight as a pilot.
Absolutely. Absolutely, because some people might not be familiar with you. So yeah, go ahead and give us the rundown on, you know, your experience and go for it. You got the floor.
Okay. Well, I wanted to be a pilot ever since I was a little kid. You know how you have these little cars or trucks that you can sit in? They're electric today, but you used to be able to push the pedals and the car or truck would go. Well, mine was an airplane. I was at age 4, so I think that was an early indication that I had an interest in flying. So, but it actually didn't start until 1968, 56 years ago. I was 19 years old, and I scraped together enough money to get into a civilian flight training program. And over the next 2 years, I got 5 commercial multi-engine rating, and then went on to a 4-year college to get a degree. And when I was getting out, the Vietnam War was still raging and I had to make service plans. So, excuse me, because I had some flight time, I chose naval aviation. And over the next 10 years, I flew 4 different aircraft in the Navy, mainly the P-3 Orion, which was a 4-engine turboprop used to track Soviet submarines during the Cold War. In 1978, I was hired as a pilot at United Airlines. And as you mentioned, over the next 25 years, I flew 6 different commercial jet aircraft. So all total, I flew 15 different aircraft over a 35-year career span, accruing 20,000 flight hours. So Why do I mention this? I'm not boasting on my accomplishments. I just want to try to gain credibility with you for me as a pilot to make the statement that with all my experience, I could not have flown the 9/11 flight profiles, and neither could the alleged Muslim hijackers because they were unqualified and inexperienced to do so. And it all ended tragically, excuse me, in 2003 when United Airlines and the FAA illegally grounded me for speaking out on safety and security issues related to 9/11. So that tragedy in my life cost me a 27-year marriage, which alienated my two kids who blame me for the divorce. They still believe the official 9/11 story, think their dad's a whacked-out conspiracy nut, and don't talk to me. It also destroyed a 35-year career in aviation and ruined my reputation as a pilot, and I lost about $4 million in paid pension and stock. So that was the price I paid for being honest and speaking out. And we could have a whole other program talking just about my grounding, but I won't go into a lot of detail unless you got any questions there, Lorianne.
Wow, I didn't realize $4 million in pensions and everything that just wiped out because you dared to speak the truth, you dared to question. Go into a little bit about, you know, what were the big things that like really peed them off enough to fire you that you were trying to point out?
Well, I was pointing out holes in the aviation safety and security system, and they couldn't have me out on the line saying what I was saying because it was showing the whole system was a farce, which I still believe it is today. So they pulled me off the line, and my union wouldn't represent me, and they wouldn't allow me to bring in an attorney, so we were at an impasse. And this went on for several months. This is the 2002-2003 time frame after 9/11. And I was somewhat naive, not realizing just how corrupt the entire government was and the whole system was. But I believe that if I covered myself with paper trail, witnesses, I recorded phone conversations, and I'll back up here for a minute. I was warned by the union lawyers and the a pilot that if I took it to the next level, I was going to get hurt. And I said, how? And they said, if they can't get you professionally or medically, they'll get you psychologically. And that's how they did it. They made me go see a shrink. I couldn't get an attorney to represent me. And they grounded me saying I was bipolar, which I'm not, because I had sought the advice and counsel of mental health professionals in Atlanta at the time. And I said, test me, I'll come for counseling, whatever it takes, which they did. And I had proof that I was mentally stable. And let me back up yet another time. There's a pilot out there last year that won her case. She was a Delta Airlines captain who fought her case. She was had a PhD in aviation safety, reported safety concerns at Delta Airlines. They pulled her off the line, made her see a shrink, and grounded her for life. But she had the money and the attorney to go after him, and it took her 8 years and $900,000, but she finally won her case. But it's identical to mine, and we've got a group for starting up that we're going to go after the FAA and these company managers for doing that. But that's a whole other story I'd like you to bring on when we finally launch our website. But after I was terminated, because I couldn't find an attorney. And why? Because United Airlines was the largest airline in the world in bankruptcy in Chicago court, a victim airline in 9/11, and there wasn't a lawyer that would touch my case, mainly because of corruption in Chicago. But so I decided I was going to go out on my own and fight this thing. And over a five-year period, I approached every relevant level and branch of the U.S. government with this, including my U.S. senator and congressman, took it all the way to two presidents, attorney generals, was up in Washington, kicking down doors, taking names, and they closed my case without hearing any of my evidence. So the system rigged against you whistleblowers, and it was totally corrupt in my case. So they still are out there denying me my day in court, or the statute of limitations, excuse me, the statute of limitations has run out on my case, so I really can't pursue this in court. So all I can do is come on programs like this, explain what happened to me and what happened to other people like me, and hope we can enlighten we're taken to the court of public opinion, and hopefully we can enlighten air travelers exactly what's going on out there, because when things like this happens, it sends a chilling signal to other would-be whistleblowers. You keep your head down and you're going to lose it. So that whole system's unsafe in that regard. So what we did, you might ask, there's 300,000 pilots in the world, roughly, and so few have spoken out on issues that I'm talking about here. And you might say, why? Well, it's twofold reason. One, most of them are afraid of getting terminated for even speaking out about 9/11. And two, there was a man named Philip Zelikow, who was the executive director of the 9/11 Commission, who screened everything that came before the commission. He actually wrote the 9/11 Commission final report outline before they even started their work. I'll give you an aside without getting too far off topic here. I interviewed a guy named Ray McGinnis who lives up in Vancouver, and he had written a book called Unanswered Questions, What the 9/11 Family Ask and what the families ask in the 9/11 Commission ignored. And he told me on this program that the 9/11 Commission wouldn't have happened had the next of kin not demanded it, and it didn't occur until 14 months after 9/11. Bush fought it the whole way. And the next of kin presented the 9/11 Commission with a whole series of questions they wanted answered. And of those questions, 70% went unanswered. And of the remaining 30%, only 10% were answered adequately, which is totally unsatisfactory. And it's directly the fault of Philip Zelikow that prevented these questions from being answered. But getting back to the pilot issue, with 300,000 pilots out there, not one single pilot was permitted to testify before the 9/11 Commission as to the absurdity of this ludicrous notion that these hijackers flew those airplanes. Not one single pilot. And that's part of the reason why we got together as a group of pilots, and 22 years after the fact, but we've been fighting this for a long time, and created our group, 9/11 Pilot Whistleblowers, which started out just as a Facebook group. And people began getting an interest in what we were saying. So we expanded it to a blog talk radio program, but we couldn't get enough pilots to come on willing to say what we were saying about 9/11. So after a while, we decided, okay, let's create a website and a YouTube channel, which we did. And on the website, I'll get into it in a minute, we interviewed pilots, and the interviews are on the website. And they're all saying the same thing I did. But I serve as director and international public spokesperson for this group, and we've got that website you mentioned at 911pilots.org, but we also have a YouTube channel at 911pilots, and I believe we've got about 57 videos on there. And we were doing these pilot interviews, and YouTube started taking them down saying they were hate speech, so we could quit doing that on YouTube. But we also, on the top of the homepage of the website, have a Join Us page, which anyone can join. It's not limited just to pilots. It's open to the general public. And all we need is your name and email address, and we'll put you on our email list to apprise you of our progress here. And finally, we have a Contact Us tab at the top of the homepage, that if you want to contact us for any reason, you can do that. But I'm rambling on here, Lori, and if you got anything you want to ask or interject here, please go ahead, but I'll ramble on some more. But
yeah, I tried to warn you that I tend to give my guests the floor, and I try not to interrupt them very often. But
I thought it was just,
it is amazing. I think that No. Your audio is choppy here and there, though.
Really?
I asked the chat room if it was just me. But once in a while, you start getting a little choppy, and then it gets back to normal again. So just FYI, I'm not sure if it's, you know, the Bluetooth headset or something like that that's causing it, or just the distance. Because for you listeners out there, he is calling from the future. He is 24 hours ahead of us. So it is actually Monday morning at about 6:25 his time. So it could be a distance kind of connection problem as well. So who knows? I don't know. But, I mean, 300,000 pilots, and I think there's probably a lot of them that are interested, but they just kind of want to be anonymous. I mean, when they hear your story and when they know how whistleblowers are treated and what they stand to lose, it gets pretty hard to be courageous enough to face that, and you've been there. And it really just, that makes me sad. It makes me sad that you were so screwed over, and also angry, as well, because, you know, but this is, you know, I don't think much has changed either. You know, whistleblowers, even now, whistleblowers, when we saw what we saw with COVID, you know, they're still discouraged. People in the healthcare industry, you know, they're still discouraged from telling their stories even about COVID. And so it's no surprise. And they use the same tactics. You know, they use the same methods as was used on you when it comes to talking about 9/11. And I guess one of the things I would like you to speak to is when you talk about the flight profile, kind of what that really means. You know, like what would it really take for a pilot to fly the planes, not only in the towers and hit them dead on, but especially the Pentagon? I think that, you know, we've all said like the Pentagon was like the smoking gun when it comes to believability of these hijackers being able to maneuver these planes. And so can you speak to that a little bit?
Sure, Lori, but Lori Ann, but if I could, I'd like to just talk about the purpose and goal of our remote control before I do that, because that's specifically what I do address is the Pentagon profile and Hani Hanjo, the hijacker. So anyhow, the purpose of our organization is to show there were no Muslim hijackers at the controls of the 9/11 aircraft, but that the aircraft were electronically hijacked and remotely controlled through employment of a system called the Uninterruptible Autopilot that takes complete control of the aircraft autopilot and flight management computer and guide the aircraft to its designated target, whether that be a building or another location. I'll talk about that in a minute. But once this system is engaged, the pilots cannot disconnect if they're along for the ride. Now, don't go turning us off until I have a chance to give you a little bit of background on remote control aircraft, because some people think maybe we're whacked out conspiracy nuts and don't want to tune us in here. But hear me out here. But our goal has been to recruit these highly trained and experienced pilots, whether they're active, retired, military, or civilian, that will be willing to sit down with us and report the issues, as I mentioned before. We just have 10 of them on the remote control page. If you go to the drop-down menu at the top, it says pilot interviews. They were all saying the same thing, so we thought, well, 10 interviews on the website's adequate for what we're saying here. But getting into remote control, most people, too many people say, there's no way you can remotely control a large commercial jet aircraft. Well, actually, remote control of aircraft dates back to 80 years, to 1944, towards the end of World War II, when U.S. Army Air Corps launched Operation Aphrodite in Europe. And what they did was take gutted out old B-17 bombers, which they did to lighten the weight of the aircraft so they could load 30,000 pounds of Torpex, which is in the highly incendiary compound on the aircraft. Now, pilots were required to make the takeoff, but once they got airborne, they'd bail out of the aircraft, and these aircraft would be remotely guided to targets in Europe. Now, this is 80 years ago, and it's your first example of military drone aircraft. And we point out on a shared video that Joe Kennedy, JFK's older brother, was killed on one of these top secret missions when his airplane blew up before he had a chance to bail out of the aircraft. So it goes into remote control of aircraft there. But we could cite a number of other examples of remote control aircraft, but instead we just jump ahead 40 years to 1984, 17 years before 9/11, when NASA and the FAA conducted a joint crash test experiment in a remote location where they took a huge four-engine Boeing 720 commercial jet aircraft, loaded it up with crash dummies and cameras because they wanted to test crew and passenger survivability in the event of a crash landing. They took this airplane off by remote control and flew it around the pattern several times before intentionally crash landing it to see the crash results. So this is 17 years before 9/11, and we got a short film clip on that on the website as well. Now, if you jump ahead to the early to mid, hang on, I hope I'm not losing, no. We jump ahead to the early to mid 90s. This system we claim the uninterruptible autopilot was developed and produced. There's a Wikipedia article. If you just Google uninterruptible autopilot or Boeing Honeywell uninterruptible autopilot, you'll get a Wikipedia article that describes the system as exactly like we're talking about here. But they claim it's misleading because they claim that it wasn't patented until 2006. Well, this is true. We've got a copy of the patent, but we also have informants that have come forward from companies such as Raytheon, Boeing, and independent mechanics that actually worked on this system in 1996 who will say the system definitely existed well before 9/11, and this is what was used to either fly the airplanes into buildings or direct them somewhere else. Now, before I get into the hijackers and the profiles you wanted me to talk about, I got to say something because I know if there's a chat room, I'll be attacked here because I always do. 9/11 pilot whistleblowers only says the hijackers couldn't have flown the airplanes and that the uninterrupted autopilot system could. We don't go into whether or not a missile hit the Pentagon, whether or not there were holograms and they used Bluetooth technology and CGI to cause people to believe that there were planes crashing in the Pentagon. And we don't even address the Shanksville, the Pennsylvania crash. All we're saying are those two things we said. So if people believe a missile hit the Pentagon, what happened to American 77? Where did it go and who flew it? If people believe it was holograms for the Twin Towers, where did American 11 and United 175 go? And we said, say in that instance, even though we don't address it, that they were able to hide somewhere else. Out over the Atlantic blown up or to an airport up in New England. So there's people that argue all these, but we say, where do you go with your evidence if you're so sure of what you're saying? I see people arguing on social media all the time, and I ask them that question. I go, okay, you've got all this information. Take it somewhere, and I'll tell you why that's an exercise in futility here in a minute. But getting into the Pentagon profile, I'll talk about the profile itself, and then I'll talk. Well, let me talk about Hani Hanjour first, the supposed 29-year-old.
Yeah, before we get into the profile and the hijackers,
yeah.
Something that, talking about remote control aircraft, and I like that you brought that up. That you know, it wasn't patented until 2006, but it absolutely did exist. And last night, I was digging around because I remember back in the day. It was like a year, maybe two, before 9/11, that I had read a story of in Australia that there was a commercial-sized aircraft that was completely remote-controlled, and they flew it internationally, and I can't remember where it went to. You know, so it went from Australia to somewhere, across the ocean and landed somewhere. And for the life of me, I could not find that article. I was, like, digging and searching using different search. And I'm like, what happened to this? It's like it's vaporized, you know. But I know for a fact that it did happen. And this was a couple of years before 9/11. So I'm right there with you. Like, I know that, you know, and they remotely controlled this commercial-sized aircraft across the ocean, so it absolutely was possible to be done.
Right.
And so I just wanted to point that out for people, too.
And if you look at military drone the Predator drone that they use today, it made its maiden flight in 1996. Okay, so that remote control technology of being able to take an airplane, I'll fly out, do its mission, and come back, existed, okay? There was another one that also launched in 96, but they scrapped it because the airplane was too unstable at low speeds, and they didn't think it was worth the effort. But on the top of the homepage on the website, there's articles, and if you go down to MH370, it refers to Malaysia Air 370, that Boeing 777 that disappeared out over the Indian Ocean. It's a 66-page document that goes into great detail about the whole evolution of this on a remote control airplane. So it's kind of technical in some regards, but if you want to read that, that gives you positive proof that it was, well, this system had been developed for decades, so we claim it was used on 9/11. But getting back to Hani Hanjour, he was a 29-year-old Saudi Arabian hijacker that came to the States in the mid-90s and took flight training. And it's well documented, including the Chicago Tribune, New York Times, ABC News, and a number of mainstream news outlets. He was a very poor student. So much so, he went back to Saudi Arabia, came back before 9/11, and tried to re-enroll in a flight school he had attended before, and they wouldn't take him because they said they didn't want to waste assets on him. So he supposedly flew the Pentagon profile. And what was that? Well, American 77 took off from Washington Dulles Airport heading towards the West Coast. And it got to cruise altitude for a while before it made a U-turn and started its descent. And at 7,000 feet, it commenced its descending, accelerating 330-degree corkscrew turn to arrive precisely at the surface. Now, this is the real trick of the maneuver, to arrive precisely at the surface at over 500 knots without skidding the aircraft on the ground to hit the Office of Naval Intelligence on his first attempt doing this. Now, this is this very poor student pilot that did this. Well, another group called 9/11 Pilots for 9/11 Truth rented some simulator time and replicated the same maneuver in a simulator. And these highly experienced pilots that tried it crashed the airplane trying the maneuver. So we're told Hani did it on his first attempt. But the story gets better than this because 1 month prior to 9/11, he goes to the freeway airport in Bowie, Maryland, and he wants to rent a little Cessna 172 single-engine prop job. Well, if you show up in an airport and they don't know you, you got to go out on an evaluation flight with an instructor. Well, Hani didn't just go out on one. He went out on three of them with two separate instructors who both reported to the chief flight instructor, Marcel Bernard, at this airport saying, don't rent him an airplane. He can't handle it, which he didn't do. And I personally talked to Marcel Bernard several months ago. He was very tight-lipped, didn't want to talk about it, said, what am I opening a case 22 years old? But anyhow, he confirmed this story for me that he did, in fact, refused rental of the aircraft. Now, why is this significant? Because Hani Hanjour went down the road to Congressional Air Charters, another fixed-base operator, and went up flying with a pilot named Eddie Shalev. And Eddie Shalev came back and said he was a good pilot. So the FBI and a staffer from the 9/11 Commission went out and interviewed all four of these pilots, the three at Freeview Airport and Eddie Shalev. So what appeared in the end, the final report, thank you very much, Philip Duckell, because he wrote the final report, only Eddie Shalev's testimony that he was a good pilot, and that was but an end note in the final commission report, and it only mentioned Eddie Shalev's name one time. So this critical information that Hani Hanjour could not fly a 172 a month prior to 9/11 was suppressed by both the FBI and the 9/11 Commission. So who was Eddie Shalev? He was an Israeli who came to the States a couple months before 9/11, and after 9/11, Congressional Air Charters closed the door and Eddie Shalev disappeared. We suspect maybe he went back to Israel. We don't know. But this is an example. They took a foreigner who had didn't testify under oath, they took his word over three other pilots who said he couldn't fly, And the result is what we have. And you look at the Pentagon hit itself. Why was that so critical? Why was it so critical that all three of these airplanes hit with military precision on their first strike? Because they wouldn't get a second attempt with the fighters that was launched, for one thing. But for in the case of the Pentagon, they were able to declare that it was an act of war and launch Operation Enduring Freedom into Afghanistan and kill over 100,000 people over 20 years. So it was critical that Hani Hanjer or whatever hit the Pentagon, if you want to believe it was a missile, I'm not arguing either way. It was critical that that airplane hit the Pentagon because they could have hit the Capitol building or the White House, but they didn't. They chose to hit the Pentagon. So that's the case. And if you look at the Twin Towers, people say to me, all they had to do is point the airplane and go. Well, you got to look at the fact that the Twin Towers are only a little over 200 feet wide, and the wingspan on a 767 is about 160 feet. So it had very little room for error. Had they been off heading by a few degrees, they would have missed the building entirely. As a matter of fact, United 175 that hit the South Tower, I thought my battery was going dead here. It hit the South Tower, 12 seconds out, it rolled into a 30-degree bank turn. And had it not done that at precisely that time at that degree angle and bank, someone's computers, the airplane would have missed the tower by 800 feet. And we claim these same maneuvers would be very difficult for highly experienced pilots. As a matter of fact, I interviewed two fighter pilots who were experienced in targeting buildings and other things on bombing runs, et cetera. And they say, no way, Dan. We wouldn't have even been able to hit it on our first attempt. So is it just a coincidence that all three hit with military precision on the first try? We don't think so. And people don't realize, I mean, when you talk about it, essentially, these airplanes are all cruise missiles because the advanced navigation system on it is derived from cruise missile technology. That's how they developed the system. So within 2 meters, they can hit a target. So very, very accurate indeed. And this is exhibited on an auto landing when the weather's down low. Pilots are required by regulations to engage the autopilot and let the airplane fly itself because the system can do better than the pilots. It puts the airplane right down on the touchdown zone and tracks down the center line of the runway, and the pilots can't regain control of the aircraft until they disconnect the autopilot. So it's extremely accurate, and we believe that was what was used on 9/11. So where do we go with our information? How much time do I have here? 16 minutes? Where do we go with our information? We decided to take it to the
U.S. Oh, you got more than that.
Okay.
You got plenty of time.
Okay.
We could start taking callers, you know, in like a half hour or something.
Oh, okay.
The last, you know, half hour, 45 minutes or so, we can bring in callers. But, you know, I like to provide my guest with, you know, an open door to speak and have one more one-on-one without interruptions. We're good.
Okay, I warned you. I'm rambling, Lorianne. So,
and I'm listening. You know, okay. This is a rambling show. One of my regulars that are in the chat room, Mike, he's just like, "Well, this is what the show is about. We all ramble."
Yeah.
Yeah. You're right at home.
Yeah. So there's another group out there called Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry, and they've run up the legal totem pole to the Supreme Court, their argument that the Twin Towers and World Trade Center building were by jet aircraft impact damages of the fuel fires that ensued. And we were initially going to latch up with them, use our pilot interviews to bring evidence before a U.S. attorney to launch a grand jury investigation into our allegations that they were remotely controlled. But they got too encumbered with what they were doing. So we decided, okay, they went the legal route. We're going to go the political route and approach politicians and bureaucrats with our contention that they were remotely controlled, and we're demanding a government investigation because normal citizens shouldn't be out conducting criminal investigations in the largest crime ever committed on American soil in its history. That's the government's responsibility. So what we did, I personally started a contact in the FBI in Washington, D.C., and a woman answered the phone, and I said, yeah, I want to report some evidence regarding a crime. And I go, she goes, what's the crime? I said, 9/11. There's a long pause. She goes, okay, what's the evidence you have? I said that the aircraft were remotely controlled and flown into the buildings, and another long pause. She goes, okay, give me your information. Well, I did, and I could tell she was totally disinterested. So she goes, okay, the FBI, if they have any further questions, they'll contact you. So I waited maybe a couple months and called them back, and they looked me up on the computer, and they said, look, we told you if we had any questions, we'd contact you. I thought, well, okay, well, you didn't contact me. And they go, no, if we have questions, we'll contact you. Well, I knew that was a waste of time. So I went to the Transportation Security Administration and talked to a very cordial gentleman for about 10 minutes and was taking in everything I said. And he goes, why don't you go to the FAA and Boeing? That's a good idea. So we went to Boeing and couldn't get our foot in the door. So after many attempts, we were finally able to get a hold of the FAA by sending a report to the hotline. And initially signed an aeronautical engineer out of Seattle to us, and who contacted me via email. And I wound up calling him back, and he said, look, I sent him a lot of information. He goes, we looked at this, and we're going to need a lot more time to digest what you sent us. So I said, okay, well, that was the last conversation I had. He wouldn't answer my emails or phone calls. So I contacted his boss from Washington, who sent me back to the FAA hotline people, who said they're going to close my case. And I said, no, you're not. So we took it to the FAA administrator, who wouldn't even acknowledge our letter, email, or phone calls. So we took it to the Secretary of Transportation, same thing. So we took it to the Transportation Inspector General's office, the same thing. A total stonewall. Ignore them, maybe they'll go away. So we went over to the justice side of the house, including the intelligence community. We contacted Avril Haines, who's the director of national intelligence, that oversees all intelligence agencies in the United States, and U.S. Attorney General, the Assistant Attorney General Criminal Division, and the FBI. And we didn't get one response from any of them, even though we made phone calls that weren't returned, emails, letters. And finally, we wrote to Biden, knowing he wasn't going to answer the letter. He probably couldn't, but anyhow, we basically said, hey, there's members of the government, in particular your cabinet, that are ignoring critical issues surrounding this huge crime. What are you going to do about it? They should be collaborating. We didn't get anywhere with it. So I live in Pakistan. I told you that I've lived over here for 14 years. People say, are you hiding out over there? No, I fell in love with and married this beautiful Pakistani lady, and we've lived here happily ever since then. So living in Pakistan, we got together and we said, well, we've run the full gamut to every relevant level and branch of the U.S. government, and we're not going to get a response because we believe they're complicit in the crime, or certain elements of the government were, and they're not going to investigate themselves. So we decided, okay, the lawyers' committee's handling the next of kin with their legal case. We'll go to another group of people that were most harmed by 9/11, and that's the 2 billion Muslims in the world, because we believe with Islamophobia still running rampant, that 2 billion Muslims would be very receptive to our notion that there were no Muslim hijackers controlling the 9/11 aircraft, which indicates Osama bin Laden didn't have this technology. It had to be an inside job. So that's what we did. I first was trying to get in to see the Prime Minister of Pakistan, Imran Khan, and I had a backdoor connection that way. He knew about me, and I was, I believe, within 2 weeks of getting in to talk to him before he was ousted from office. But when I was going through that process, they said I had to go through his military sector, which I did, and they called me to talk to him about it. And then they didn't call me back, so I contacted the Inner Services Intelligence, which is the CIA of Pakistan. And on March 7, 2022, they invited me in, and I talked with a colonel for about an hour, and went into great detail, not just about what 9/11 pilot whistleblowers is about, but other 9/11 truth screws out there, what kind of information we have available. And they seemed very interested, said they were going to bring me back in to meet the director general. They were going to sign a film crew to me to do a documentary, et cetera. And then the ouster of Imran Khan happened, and that fell apart. But above and beyond that, we know that the Inner Services Intelligence works with the CIA, and they probably knew about my visit before the door slammed behind me. So we thought we're not going to get there because Pakistan's an IMF debt slave and they're intelligently dependent upon the U.S. for aid and trade. So we decided we were going to give up on the Muslim community. And there's an organization called the Organization of Islamic Cooperation that's based in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. And this organization boasts itself to be the collective voice of the Muslim world. It's like the United Nations of the Muslim world, and it's the largest such organization outside the UN. And so we thought, okay, we'll go to this organization whose representatives are the foreign ministries from 57 nations that are member nations of the OIC. So we started out, I wrote the Secretary General of the organization. Didn't get a response by letter or email, so I called them, and they were going to assign a person to me. And they didn't. They gave me an email address that they didn't respond. So we decided we were going to keep trying to call them, and when I would, they'd put me on hold, and then it would hang up on me. So we thought, well, we're not going to get anywhere there. So lo and behold, about a month later, this video clip we caught, it was only 3 minutes long. The Secretary General was in Moscow with his whole contingent, sitting across the table from Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, and they were talking about how Russia and the Islamic world were improving their ties and were going to work together in the future. So I thought, well, that's an idea. If the U.S. government and Western governments are disinterested in what we were asking for is, hey, how about creating an international Islamic commission for 9/11 inquiry, a Muslim 9/11 commission, where you can gather all this information from all these 9/11 truth groups, compile all the information and promulgate it to everybody, especially the 2 billion Muslims in the world, that would show that it was an inside job. So we decided I'd write a letter to Sergei Lavrov, a dual letter, and Secretary General of the OIC, Taha. And so we decided that, okay, let's bring China into this thing. So we wrote a joint letter to Xi Jinping, Putin, and these two sectors. There was another organization we joined in with this, the Muslim World League over in Mecca, Saudi Arabia. So we wrote a letter saying the same thing. And hey, guys, why don't we all get together? We've got access to all this information. And we'll create this commission. Well, for the most part, what we did was try to establish a paper trail that we could reference when we wrote other people. And I'm going to leave you hanging because that's where we are right now. I won't go into who's contacted us or who we've contacted or whatever, but we've run the full gamut in the U.S., internationally. And then you got to ask yourself, if these countries that have a political interest in moving forward with this don't respond to our request, given the evidence and information out there, who will? Well, the answer is no one. So all these 9/11 truth groups out there that are scrambling for attention, I always say to them, where are you going to take all this evidence you have? And they don't have a question for me. I said, you're going to take it to the CIA? The FBI, they're not going to listen to you. So we're in a quandary here as far as all these truth groups go, because I see all this arguing going on Facebook and nobody getting anywhere with their arguments. So I've been doing podcasts, TV and radio programs online around the world, actually, and trying to get the word out just like I am here right today. And I've tried to get a hold of Tucker Carlson, Joe Rogan, Alex Jones, Jimmy Dore, And there's a Muslim program in Chicago that has a huge following called The Dean Show. And they've contacted me back but never got back yet. It's a TV program. And I thought that would be an excellent opportunity to get her answer that there were no Muslim hijackers controlling the aircraft out there. So you had mentioned the documentary, Lorianne. It's called 9/11, The Advent of the Ninth Crusade. And if you go to this, I think it's the second item on our drop-down menu, it says pilot documentary, I think. And if you watch that, it basically, with the exception of the guy who did the voiceover, Chuck Huber, who came and voluntarily offered his services gratis, he did an excellent job. But the rest of us were a bunch of rookie filmmakers putting things together, but it was the efforts of people on three continents working online that we were able to put this hour 45-minute documentary together. So if you watch it, please pass it on via social media and otherwise. And if you don't want to watch it, at least watch the last 5 minutes of it, because it's a tearjerker. I well up every time I watch a thing, and I help produce it. So that's a documentary. And as far as I go, if you want to contact me, contact on our website, but I'm on Twitter at DanHanley4. If you want to follow me there and send me a direct message, I'll respond to you there. That's how I get invited on a lot of programs. I'm also on Facebook at Dan Hanley, but I'm at my 5,000 friend limit, so you can follow me there and also communicate with me via Facebook message. So I've pretty much exhausted what I'm going to say here. Lorianne, if you got any questions or comments.
Yeah, and for those of you listening, and if you're listening online, I did put a link to that 9/11 pilots documentary in the show description, so you can find it there. I've also posted it on my Facebook page as well. And I remember watching it, you know, quite a while back, and then a couple of days ago I rewatched it just to refresh my memory on it. And it is very good, and, you know, it just kind of, it gives you that sense that, you know, you aren't just this lone voice out there, that there are other pilots that question what happened as well. And I can't help but think that, like, you know, I do think that there's a strong case for remote control. Like I said, you know, I could not find for the life of me that article, you know, with that Australian flight, the commercial-sized aircraft that was remote controlled, that went over the ocean. It was successful. Could not find it for the life of me. And that happened, you know, at least a year or two before 9/11 happened. So this technology did exist. So there's a very strong case for that. And then you had mentioned, too, like, you know, it's not, you know, 9/11, it was not this big surprise that the media and Bush and everybody was saying, like, oh, we couldn't have imagined that this would happen. You know,
right.
Like, no, actually, you know, there was training for this. There was preparation for this. They had, you know, plans in place. And if there were hijackers on these planes, then it's quite likely that their purpose was to create the situation in which the pilots would turn on this automatic navigation system to be remotely controlled, right? You know, you got hijackers, they're banging on the door, they're trying to get in, they're threatening the passengers. That would create the exact kind of scenario in which a pilot most likely would have been trained to go, okay, let's turn on this remote control.
Let me interrupt you there for a second. This system, to date, is little known amongst the pilot community or the general public. We interview pilots and we bring them in and we talk about just the hijackers and so forth. Say, no way. And we go, yes way. It does exist, and it existed before 9/11. So pilots don't know about it. And that Wikipedia article I mentioned talked about a switch that the pilot can activate in the cockpit. There was no such thing on 9/11. These pilots couldn't have known to activate the system because they did not even know it existed. Now, getting back to the idea that the aircraft were remotely controlled, let me ask you this question. We know something happened at those three buildings that caused an explosion, whatever you want to believe happened, okay? We suspect strongly that there were hijackers on board, which we claim were patsies, okay? So, but if the planes didn't hit the Pentagon or the Twin Towers, what did? And if they did, who flew the airplane? And we say it couldn't have been the hijackers. So it leaves the only viable alternative explanation is through employment of the system, Lori. Well, if somebody has another option on how this could have happened, given that experienced pilots couldn't fly the profiles, I'm all ears as to what you believe. But we said, how else could they have hit the pilot those buildings with such accuracy? Lori?
I mean, it would have to be programmed. You know, it would have to be, you're not just going to be able to do that on a whim, you know, especially if you're not experienced, then that kind of is exactly what we're talking about. It's like there would have, you know, like I said, remote control makes the most sense. And if there were, quote unquote, hijackers, it would make a good cover, you know, good cover story.
Exactly.
You know, maybe to get everybody, you know, using their cell phones to say their last goodbyes to their loved ones and create that whole, you know, like a Hollywood movie, you know, but in action.
Well, I lost my train of thought. Let me think real quick. Nope, it's not coming back. But the,
that happens.
I cannot remember what I was going to say. I had a thought and I can't bring it back to me, but it had to do with the uninterrupted autopilot. Oh, yeah, I know what I was going to say. How the system actually operates, because we didn't even cover that. What happens with this uninterrupted autopilot, navigation system information can be data linked into the airplane's computer directly, whether it be a satellite, another airplane, or a ground station. Okay? So when this system's engaged by a remote source, they upload all this information, and it could actually have been uploaded before the airplane took off, because what happens with this flight management computer, what's programmed in there is a course, altitude, and speed for each of the waypoints along a route of flight. And if certain modes of flight management computer are engaged, it's a cruise missile. It's going to do exactly what's in that's been programmed into that flight management computer. So it isn't something that the hijackers themselves would have had to program, or the pilots could have programmed in there, because they didn't know it existed. It was all done externally. I'm talking with other groups out there, and they're trying to rebuild this system, and they're not pilots, and they don't have any exposure to glass cockpit airplanes. And they go, well, there has to have been a homing signal in the building. They go, no, there doesn't. It's all internal to the flight management computer and the autopilot interface. So there's a lot of misconception about what the system does and what its capabilities and limitations are. But the big thing is the pilots don't know about it. They still don't know about it. If there's pilots listening to this right now, they probably don't believe what I'm saying is true, but I offer them to go look at that 66-page document on the website and watch the videos that we have on our website, because the website itself is really easy to read. And there's several videos on there that go into detail explaining things. And we believe that particularly if you go to the airplane, cockpits, hijackers, and remote control pages on the drop-down menu, that will convince you. And we don't come out and say, hey, this ground station linked this information up to the aircraft to cause it to crash like this. We present, we're not conspiracy theorists. There's conspiracy theorists and then there's conspiracy facts. And what we do is present you with a series of facts. And at the end of this website, we say, you be the judge. Was it the hijackers or the remote control system? So we leave it to the reader to decide. But I've gotten so many responses on social media saying, you totally convinced me. You're right. So it was my aha moment, because after I got terminated, I started intensely going into the 9/11 truth movement. As a matter of fact, I was involved in the 9/11 truth movement before it even existed. So I started in January 2007, because was scratching my head, and because I flew Cessnas in the late 60s and also flew the 757 aircraft, I could not figure out how these guys could have flown it. I knew they couldn't have. And a friend of mine named Captain Phil McConnell, who I latched up with in 2006, comes out in 2007 with this exposure of the system. And that was my aha moment. That's how they did it. They were remotely controlled. They didn't fly them at all. So I think that people reading the website will have their aha moment when they read it.
I think I've had a lot of aha moments. I mean, a lot of times I like to talk about, our 9/11 truth origin story, put it that way. And with me, it was that very day. I'm here on the West Coast. My roommate and one of my best friends and I had an early morning class for computer school. So we were up early in the morning. And, and the first tower had been hit, and it was in flames. And then, obviously, we saw what was going on in the news, and we're watching this happen, and we're like, yeah, we're not going to class today. And we were just glued to the TV after that. And so we're watching all this unfold, and then pretty soon, the first tower goes down. Now, and this friend of mine and I, we had watched documentaries on controlled demolition, and because we're both kind of pyros, and so we'd watched plenty of documentaries and whenever there was a controlled demolition of a building somewhere, we liked to watch it. And so when the first tower went down, we were just like, it was immediate to both of us. We looked at each other at almost the exact same moment and we're like, that was a controlled demolition. There is no way that thing came down, on its own.
Yeah.
And then the second tower came down and it just confirmed it because the second tower came down almost identical to the first. And, it was just like, this is, it was like a whoa, and then just following the media and how it was like immediately blamed on Osama bin Laden, even though Osama bin Laden hadn't taken credit for it. And it was like, how did they know so quickly? We were just glued and glued and glued to everything that happened that day on the television and flipping channels, seeing what different news stations were saying. And he and I were just like, man, this is huge. This is way huge. This is more than, just some, freedom American hating hijackers that have done this. There's no way that all of that would have been successful. And the more we dug into it and that as time went on, we saw so many articles and so many interviews being completely scrubbed. You couldn't find them anymore. It was just like, man, this is a very systematic effort that went on 9/11, the biggest in my lifetime and in my memory. And so, yeah, 9/11 truth happened for me almost right away.
Yeah. Well, it took me, I got terminated, and I went back to school, actually, deciding because of my age, I was 54 at the time, deciding that I was going to be a psychologist and start taking courses at Georgia State University, but which kind of sidetracked my thought process. I was still involved with a young student who knew my story, saying, you got to get on TV, Dan. You got to tell the story on TV. So it took me a little bit of time before I got my bearings to realize all this stuff. And then, actually, I don't think the 9/11 truth movement actually took off until, I think, Facebook came in 2004, maybe Twitter 2006. But it was around that time frame when this information interchange occurred that all these facts and evidence coming out around the event surfaced that I got involved. And to the best of my knowledge, I mentioned that group, Pilots for 9/11 Truth. Their founder passed away from cancer a few years ago. And I think their website's still out there, but there's nobody at the helm. So to the best of my knowledge, we're the only 9/11 pilot truth group out here. And if anybody knows of any other one, please message me via those communication links I gave you and let us know, because we'd like to get other pilots involved.
Well, if I knew any other pilots that would jump on board, I would certainly try to help. But, you know, yeah, I think that there is just so much that we can get into. I think people have to also kind of bring their brains back to over 20 years ago as well. And of course, you know, pilots now might find it a little more, unbelievable, because, you know, they're current pilots. They haven't, you know, if they haven't been up in the air flying for, you know, for over 20 years, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So the capabilities that we have now are different than what they were over 20 years ago. Yet, there was a lot more capability than I think people are really aware of. And I think that's one of the things that you try to point out, is that, you know, this technology that people, you know, this remote control technology and things, they don't want to believe that it was as advanced as it was over 20 years ago.
Right.
But it really was.
Right, it was. As a matter of fact, there's another paper on the website on the articles drop-down menu. If you go to... there's two of them, actually. Mark Gaffney wrote one of them, a friend of mine who lives out in Oregon. And it was how the FBI and the 9/11 Commission suppressed key evidence about Hani Hanjour, the alleged hijacker of American 77. And that's where I told a lot of the information I just told you off Mark's article. But it goes into great detail talking about Eddie Shalev and everything else. So read that one. Then right beneath it or above it, it says Monahan. Okay, he wrote a paper, he's another friend of mine, lives out in Las Vegas, okay, and it's called The Plausibility of 9/11 Attacks Generated by GPS Guided Aircraft Autopilot System. And he explains in his paper here how coming into 9/11, great enhancements were made to the accuracy of the system, both internal to the aircraft and external. So if you read that article, it further strengthens our belief that they had planned this thing. And some people say, well, they must have planned this thing in 2000. And no, this has been going on for decades, the idea of doing this thing. And then other people say to me, George Bush did 9/11. I go, no. It goes much higher than that. I mean, I don't know what your worldview is, Lorianne, but I believe there's a massive conglomerate out there that actually controls the world. Whether you want to believe that is the Jesuits in the Vatican, the Committee of 300, the Bilderbergs, the Rothschilds, I could go on and on, the Council on Foreign Relations, Illuminati, whatever you want to believe in your worldview, I believe that they got together and decided they were going to do this for multiple reasons, and it was in the planning stages. And I also will go further on to say, and I can't prove this, I've read Christopher Bowen's book, Solving 9/11, and I haven't read David Icke's book, The Trigger, which is a very thick compilation of facts, but I personally believe that the whole operation was planned and executed by Zionist members of the governments of Israel, the United States, Great Britain, and others through collusion between the Mossad, CIA, MI6, and others. And I could go on to why Israel would be involved. Someone asked a question they could, or what the motive the United States would have had for conducting this operation. But, you know, every crime needs a means and a motive, and so Osama bin Laden certainly didn't have the means to pull this off. He may have had a motive, but it would have been insane suicide for him to take on the biggest powers in the world the way he did, so... We say that both Israel and
He was already at death's door anyway with, you know, suffering from renal failure and needing dialysis.
Right. Exactly. The story, you know, and then they, supposedly evaded the most sophisticated air defense system in the world for over an hour before doing all this stuff. So the whole thing that they took the airplanes with box cutters and Osama bin Laden in a cave in the mountainous regions of Afghanistan, armed with a laptop and a cell phone, could have pulled this off. It's really, we go into this on our documentary, it's like, it's ludicrous. You know, when you look at it face value, it's ludicrous that what people believe. And we also believe that, I mean, Lori, did you believe that the pilots had flew the airplane? Did you give it a second thought? I mean, they told you these 19 angry Muslim Arab hijackers commandeered these aircraft. Did you give it a second thought? Wait, maybe they couldn't have flown them. Well, no, most people didn't, because you're not pilots. I'm not talking down to you, but you cannot conceive how absurd it is, given their flight credentials and the profiles they supposedly have flown, how absurd it is that they did it. So that's the other thing we're trying to do, is open people's eyes to, hey, look at the original story and look at what qualifications these guys had or lack thereof. And we're trying to open their eyes to that and then say, well, how could it have happened? And that's when we introduced the uninterruptible autopilot system.
Exactly. I mean, I think, you know, right at first, I mean, like I said, you know, from that moment, you know, I already wasn't believing what we were being told. And so I questioned a lot of it. And with that being said, if you're ready, we do have three people raising their hand right now on the switchboard. Did you need to take a couple minute anything like that before we bring in callers, or are you ready?
I'm ready to go. I'm ready.
Beautiful. Okay. So there is a 206 number raising their hand that I don't recognize. Most of the people that are raising their hand right now are people that I know and familiar with. So I'm going to bring on 206 first so we can find out who it is that we got. Hi, 206. Who do we have?
Oh, I didn't realize I was going to be talking. Hi, Dan. It's Lynn.
Oh, hi, Lynn. Jensen. How you doing? Yes, how
I'm
you doing?
Good. Very good. Very good show. It was good to hear you speak again. Well, my heart just goes out to you. You know that.
Yeah.
I pray for you. Thank I pray you. For your safety. I don't really have any questions, but, you know, I'm in your corner, so... I'll just let you
continue
thank you,
Lynn.
With your other yeah.
I appreciate the support, Lynn. I will.
Yes, for sure. Okay.
Well, Lori,
yeah, thank you for calling
some,
in.
Let me just inject something here, the Philip Marshall story that people probably aren't familiar with, but Philip Marshall was a United Airlines 767 captain who had written two books on 9/11 and was about to publish a third book, when he told his neighbors and his ex-wife, hey, look, I'm being threatened. And a couple of days later, they found Philip's family dog and two teenage kids shot to death in their California home, and he had a bullet in his head, and the police labeled it a murder-suicide. So I'm aware of people. I just was on a program in the UK, and the host said to me, why aren't you dead? I said, I don't know. And safety. I'm aware of the hazards of whistleblowing. Case in point is the Boeing whistleblower that was supposedly committed suicide before he's supposed to testify a second day over a Boeing case. So thank you, Lynn, for your prayers.
Yeah, I'm forgetting
support.
His name. I'm forgetting his name, but yeah, I saw that he had actually done a video a few days before he died, literally saying, you know, if I'm suicided, I have no intention of killing myself. So if I disappear, you know, something's
yeah.
up. Like, you know, he made a video, like, you know, so, and, you know, apparently, you know, those who put out the hit order on him to suicide him weren't aware that he put out a video
<That's>
literally
good.
Saying that, no, I'm not suicidal. So, yeah, and let's go ahead, and I'm going to bring on some people that I know. We got Pianchi. I'm going to bring on Pianchi. I'm going to bring you all in one at a time here to hopefully not talk over each other. So, Pianchi, you have any questions or comments for Dan?
Well, it's one thing for sure. You had to be accurate. They had to be accurate on the plane strikes and couldn't miss. Because they wouldn't have a second chance. And
right.
Then if they didn't have a second chance, what are you going to do with all those explosions that's in those two buildings?
Exactly.
That's it.
Yeah. That's what they had to be right on, pinpoint accuracy on their first attempt for the mission to have been accomplished on all three buildings. And we say the probability of that occurring, given everything, is zero, that it could have happened. So, you got another caller
there? I'm right there with you. Yeah, next up I'm going to bring in Joe Gibson. And Joe Gibson, he has his own interesting story, but I want to give him the chance to, hey, Joe Gibson, you are on. Do you have a question or comment for Dan?
I know the government's corrupt and there's a lot of questions, but I don't know if I buy into the, like when people say, you know, there was explosions and stuff like that, I'm from Connecticut, actually, and I was, you know, around that day when that happened, and I know people that were there at Ground Zero. There was no explosions, and the planes did hit the towers. There's eyewitnesses that have seen it, thousands of eyewitnesses that have seen the plane hit the towers. So, you know, but my question is, you know, for instance, how do you explain the reports that came out, like United Flight 175 was at 8:47 a.m. when the plane changed beacon codes twice in a minute, and then a few minutes later deviated from its assigned altitude and ignored New York air traffic controllers' repeated attempts to contact it. And then at 8:52, one of the passengers called his father and said, I'm on a satellite phone, because cell phones don't work at that altitude, satellite phones do. Father and said, I think they've taken over the cockpit, and an attendant has been stabbed, and someone else up front may have been killed. So when you live in a world today where 10 people can't keep a secret, you know? So, but I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm just saying that, yeah, I know the government's corrupt, and I know, obviously they were targeted for a reason, the towers, for a lot of reasons in the global elite plans. But I just don't know if I could get that theory that there was no planes and there was explosions planted there and a missile hit the Pentagon. You know, I can't go that far out with that story. You know, so I just wanted to make that comment. Go ahead.
Yeah, like I said, we don't embrace any theory other than the hijackers couldn't have flown and the uninterrupted autopilot could, because we feel like we don't have to go any further than that with what we're saying, because that by itself blows the holy hell out of the official story. But as far as explosions go in the tires, I don't know if you're familiar with the William Rodriguez story, but there was actually an explosion that occurred in the north tower before the first airplane hit it in one of the sub basements down it was before impact, okay? And William Rodriguez was a janitor who maintained the cleanliness of the stairwells of the north tower. And this sudden explosion occurred, and he ran outside, unlocked doors, let firefighters and first responders in, and he actually went up the stairs with them and help them bring people out of the building. And right before the building collapsed, he jumped underneath a truck outside, and somebody saw him trapped down there, ran away, and they came back for him and found him and pulled him out from under the truck. And he was called in the news the last man out, the hero of 9/11, and Bush caught wind of this story and brought him up to the White House for a hero's welcome, gave him a hero award. And he's surrounded by senators, politicians, and they're going to say, we're going to do a book deal, we want you to run for public office, et cetera, until William got before a committee and said, oh, by the way, before the plane hit, there was this massive explosion in the basement, right? Which all of a sudden, the fanfare vaporized. Everybody ran away from politicians, the media, the book deals went away, the movie deals, everything. So
yeah, I believe it.
For 20 years, he's gone around the world. He had help financially, but has given a talk. They used to have a bunch of his YouTube videos on there, on the internet, but most of them are gone now. But he's explained this story to even dignitaries like Mahathir Mohamad in Malaysia and Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. He's gone to these foreign countries and saying, hey, look, here's what happened. And it happened before 9/11. So that's one example of an explosion occurring in the buildings. But you talked about United 175 hitting the South Tower. There are some people who believe, you talk about the transponder code changes and everything, there are some people who believe, although again, how do you prove this, that there was an airborne swap of aircraft over Stewart Air Force Base for American 11 that hit the North Tower and United 175 that hit the South Tower, and that something, they did something with the passenger planes, I don't know what, and well, Rebecca Roth, this author, claims that they were taken up to a New England airport, required to make phone calls, and were snuffed, but she's got three books out on that. But there is a photograph out there that was four photographs taken by independent photographers, including CNN, that shows this pod on the underbelly of the 767 about to hit the tower. Now, that pod doesn't exist on a 767. I flew them. It's smooth on the bottom of the aircraft. So some people believe that because of this, and the photograph was analyzed by a Spanish photography expert, and they concluded that that pod did actually exist. It wasn't a Photoshop photo or anything like that. So if there was a pod on the plane that hit the South Tower, it was not United 175. So if that's why the transponder changes occurred, we don't know. But again, you got all these people out there, and I go, okay, where are you taking it? CIA? So.
Well, yeah. No, but one thing somebody did say, also, Osama bin Laden, he did take credit for the attacks. I mean, well, I know you mentioned the Muslims, and what, you say you live in Pakistan now? Is that what
yes,
you said?
I do.
And you're married?
I'm surrounded by 240 million Muslims, the second most densely populated Muslim country in the world.
Yeah.
Firsthand on the news here. Go ahead.
No, I wanted to ask you, what is their reaction over there in Pakistan to 9/11? I mean, because you said you were trying to get Muslim support. What's their reaction?
Well, it's difficult to get on. I was on, never mind Pakistan. I was on one national TV program, and my opening remark was there were no, Osama bin Laden had nothing whatsoever to do with 9/11. And that was the last statement the moderator allowed me to make that strong. The rest of the questions were powder puff. Everybody's afraid to talk about it. I did a radio program in Casablanca, Morocco, and two of them TV spots on Malaysian TV. But other than that, it's next to impossible to get on Islamic TV stations. I tried to get on Press TV in Tehran, Iran, and on Tolo TV in Kabul, Afghanistan, with no luck. But as far as Pakistan itself, we created these flyers, and the top emblazoned in red letters is there were no Muslim hijackers controlling the 9/11 aircraft. And I just decided to sample the waters. I went down to the local mosque and stood outside. And as I came out, I didn't have a megaphone or anything. I just said, there were no Muslim hijackers that controlled the 9/11 aircraft. Well, it didn't take long before I had a large group of Muslims around me, and I started handing out. I couldn't hand out the flyers fast enough, and I got mobbed. They wanted to know. They said, well, what are we supposed to do about it? I said, make copies of the flyers and distribute them all. How do you get out to 2 billion people that there were no Muslim hijackers controlling the aircraft? You can't just do it distributing flyers, getting on TV stations help, but that's impossible to get on major stations. To answer your question, the limited exposure I've had to the Islamic public in Pakistan has been overwhelming, how they're receptive. And so many people I've talked to that I bring this system up is, get out of here. You couldn't have, you know, and most people won't believe it, and they're going, oh, he's just a nut. Most people won't believe it till they get on the website. And so my whole purpose of doing programs such as this is to say 911pilots.org over and over again so people go to it and look at the website. I've had TV stations that on the banner on the lower side of the screen, that's all they're flashing the whole time I'm on because I've asked them to do it at 911pods.org. So.
Yeah. That was my real question, actually, at the end here. What's your goal? Obviously, you know, what's the goal here, the end result goal? What are you seeking to have resolved, and what do you want to see done?
Well, I'd like to see total exposure of the lies of 9/11, of course, but done here. Try to enlighten and upset 2 billion Muslims and the other 6 billion people on the planet with information any way we can get it out there, because we're not going to get anywhere in the court system. The lawyers committee proved that, and we proved running the full gamut in the political system in the United States, we're not going to get anywhere. So the only hope we have is to enlighten the global population any way we can. So hopefully that the public outcry would be deafening and something would come of it. So.
All right. Well, just because I just don't understand, like, for instance, if everything you say is true, let's just say the scales of justice will tip it the other way. What was the reason, though? What was the goal to be accomplished by these people that wanted to take down the towers, you know? I mean, obviously not to just go to war. I mean, what was the real goal, you know?
Okay, that's a good question. I didn't tell you before, but I will now. Every crime or most crimes have a means and a motive. Well, I said Osama bin Laden certainly didn't have the means to employ the remote control autopilot system. But Israel, who was an early founder after the 71 war in the Middle East, Israel started then to develop drone technology. So they certainly had the means to do what they did, and they're experts in the field now, as is the United States. I told you about the development of these systems, and if you read that 66-page article, you'll see that they had the means to use this system. Now, what was the motive? Osama bin Laden supposedly hated the American way of life and wanted to conduct these attacks. And you said he admitted to it? Well, that depends upon your source. I mean, he did get on a BBC, I mean, Al Jazeera interview and said, I didn't do it, so... There's some people, and you can present to me the articles, and I've read them, or the videos, I've listened to those, but there are instances where he claimed that Muslims would never do this, and he wouldn't do it either. So to me, the jury's still out on that issue, but as far as the motive goes for Israel, have you ever heard of the Greater Israel Project?
Yes, I have.
Okay, well, let me just touch on it briefly in case people haven't heard of it. It's also called the Odin Yenon Plan. And what Israel Zionists claim is that they have a right to all lands from the Euphrates to the Nile River. And they call it the Greater Israel Project or their promised land, their biblically prophesied promised land. And I believe what's going on in Gaza right now is a continuation of what they did after 9/11, and that was an attempt to go in and destabilize or topple 7 governments in 5 years. And General Wesley Clark had a video out there where he claims he was in the Pentagon, saw the plans, that's what they were going to do. Well, they weren't successful, and I believe they're going to try to do it right now with Iran being the principal target and all of it. But as far as the United States goes, some people estimate the war on terror cost the United States $6 trillion. Well, I think it was a lot more than that, given the debt that we're in right now. But who profited from that? Who did? The Carlyle Group, all the military and industrial complex organizations involved there made massive profits off this. So there's profits to be made in war, and they're still doing it in the Ukraine and Gaza today. So that was the motive, and the U.S. had the means, and that's why we say they're prime suspects. But you really should go read Christopher Bullen's book, Solving 9/11, and I haven't read it, but David Icke's book, The Trigger, and very convincing arguments that it wasn't Osama bin Laden and was the two parties I just mentioned.
Well, Osama bin Laden, I mean, you keep saying Osama bin Laden, but the Muslim element of it is there is factions of the Muslim community that can't stand Western world. They will kill so you agree there are terrorists out. I mean, it's not like the Muslims are all innocent and they're all peace, safety, and love around the world. You know,
I agree with that. I agree with what you're saying there. All I'm saying with regard to the crime of 9/11, which it trampled the religion and persecuted 2 billion Muslims for a crime we claim Muslims didn't commit. So why am I doing what
exactly.
I'm doing? I'm 75 years old and I don't have to be out here saying and doing what I'm doing, but I feel like I know too much about the lies of 9/11 to remain silent. And I'm doing it on behalf of the next of kin who were denied due process of law and are still being suppressed by the government. But not only them, I'm doing it for the millions of Muslims and other in the Middle East and South Asia who have been killed, maimed, or displaced as a result of these lies. So I know the lies, and that's what I'm out there spreading the truth about them. And I don't have to be doing it. And some people, you haven't asked the question. Some host asked me, Lorianne, the last one I did in the UK, he goes, why are you still alive? I go, I don't know. And I don't know. I know that people are targeted that speak out on issues like 9/11. And I could be targeted. I know this much. The FBI and TSA questions me every time I come in to leave the state because they know I'm a big mouth loose cannon whistleblower sitting amongst 240 million Muslims in Pakistan saying there were no Muslim hijackers at the controls. So I'm sure they don't like that I'm saying that, but I don't care.
Well, and that's probably why. You know, you're already a very known, outspoken person. You're not some unknown person that they can just, you know, easily target and assassinate. They probably figure they've done a good enough job discrediting you and destroying your life that you're not really that much of a threat anymore. That would be my guess. I would like to also bring on the next caller. I'm going to bring on Gunslinger. He's a regular, and I'm going to see if Gunslinger has any questions or comments for you. Hey,
okay.
Gunslinger.
Hey. Glad you're doing the excellent job over there, no doubt. I agree 100% on the technical aspects, okay, because I'm a retired master electrician, electrical engineer, okay. I've flown remote control airplanes when I was a kid, and I'm 60 years old, okay. So it can be done, okay. People out there are just uneducated about this stuff, and I was even a student pilot for a long time. Okay, I've flown a little Cessna 150, 172s, 182s, stuff like that. Okay, so a person that cannot pass a simple flying of a 172, and you're expected to fly a commercial airplane like that? Oh, come on, Santa Claus can do a better job than that. Okay,
exactly.
So that means it didn't happen. It didn't happen. There was no way that you can take a person just. Don't even have no flight experience, no experience around airplanes or anything like that, and put them in the seat of that big commercial airplane, okay, and expect them to fly precisionally into those buildings. Impossible.
Right. Right.
And what about the Pentagon?
Go ahead. I'm sorry. No, you go ahead.
Oh, and for the Pentagon, there was, what, 100 and something surveillance cameras all around that building, okay? I've installed surveillance systems, being a master electrician. I know how surveillance systems work, okay? But yet, we only get one little bitty glimpse of something, missile, airplane, whatever, when there was over 100 cameras active that day across the street, on street poles, in bushes, on the corners of the building. But yet, we only see this one little bitty thing. And remember, that Pentagon can withstand a direct nuclear hit from a nuclear bomb.
Right.
You know?
Well,
so,
not only did the FBI come in and confiscate all those cameras, they took one from a Virginia Highway Patrol car, surveillance camera on a DoubleTree hotel and one over at Citgo gas station. And the reason that they confiscated all these things, the government claims, was for national security reasons. Give me a break. Why would that be national security reasons? And the people that say, no, it's a Pentagon, no, it's a missile, no, it's an airplane. So we're trying to get the government to release the film because we'll never know for certain what it was until they do, which they'll never do.
No.
U.S. government will never open an investigation into 9/11. There's too many people that they could bring before a committee and destroy their story.
Oh, yeah. There's too many people that can go to prison, too, because we know something hit it, be it an airplane, be it a missile, whatever. I don't know if you ever heard of Dr. Judy Wood.
Of course.
Put out a book. Where did the towers go? Where did the towers go? Okay.
Right.
Now, she based hers on a energy weapon, which could be.
Right.
Who knows? Okay.
Right.
We do have the technology. The government has the technology to produce these directional energy weapons. Okay.
Right.
Very simple. I mean, they've had that for probably, I'd say, 40 or 50 years, and it was all based on Tesla technology. Remember Tesla? Greatest
right.
electrical mind in the whole world, okay, at the time. So they took his technology and took it and perfected these directed energy weapons because there's too many strange things that went on in 9/11 in those buildings that, you know, odd explosion, the bathtub effect, I'm sure you heard about that, that
right.
the thing came down and made just a little glitch on a Richter scale, like an earthquake. It was hardly nothing. Million-ton building each coming down, and it didn't. It just made a little glitch on the Richter scale. What happened to them?
If you look at the details, okay, you've got 550,000 tons of steel and concrete collapsing
right.
to the surface at near the free-fall acceleration due to gravity in less than 11 seconds,
right.
almost identically. Into a debris field that was only 3 stories tall when it should have been 30 stories tall. How do you vaporize? How do you dustify steel and concrete like that? And unfortunately, Judy Wood's theories are rejected by so many in the 9/11 truth movement. I had a guy, a Scottish gentleman, 64-year-old Scottish gentleman, tearing me apart on Twitter saying, trying to convince me it was a Judy Wood's technology. I go, I'm not denying it was. I said, it could have been nanothermite, Judy Wood, and the explosion in the basement. All three brought them down. So I don't discount anything.
Well, you know, let me finish one thing. If they claim that they, you know, if it was an airplane, quote unquote, they said that the fuel weakened all that steel. Well, the fuel burnt through and blew out the other side. Jet fuel does not burn hot enough to melt steel or even weaken it. It would have to take
right.
hours and hours. And remember, all that steel had that asbestos coating for fire resistant per
right.
New York City fire codes. So they had a 1 hour fire resistant coating on all that steel. Okay. So it had to withstand that kind of temperature for at least 1 hour, and they came down less than an hour. Explain that.
You talk about jet fuel. It burns at a temperature of 1,500 degrees, and steel
That's
melts
right.
at a temperature of 2,750. So there was molten
That's
iron
right.
pouring out of the steel buildings before
yep.
it came down, and afterwards, for weeks, if not months, it was like a steel
That's
foundry.
Right.
They said it was like lava flowing in the ruins down
yep.
the basement of the building. So what actually caused this steel to melt? Well, there's a group of scientists that got together, and they collected samples in different areas, and they analyzed it using the scientific method and concluded
right.
that there's a highly explosive subcompound called nanothermite that burns at a temperature in excess of 4,000 degrees, and they're claiming that's
right.
what melted the steel. So the nanothermite was present in the debris
mm-hmm.
field. But
yep.
I'm still saying...
Yeah, Richard Gates talks a lot about that, and it also would be able to slice a steel beam at exactly a 45 degree angle, you know, too. So right. It's like, you know, jet fuel can't do that. Jet fuel can't, you know, do a precision slice through steel like that. It's something
right.
else has to.
Look, he's out. Whoever said it was nanothermite, it's the same substance that they use to connect railroad rails together. He's absolutely right.
Yep.
I've seen pictures of column shafts where they were burnt on a 45-degree angle, which permitted the upper shaft to slide by the lower shaft. Another point. I would have slept on the lobby of those buildings for all night long, and you could have ran planes in at that elevation. It wasn't going to come down like that.
Right.
It wasn't going to come down like that. So that's and they had to and you had to have precision flights, because if you had a miss and you got all this that explosive there in place, now what? Now
exactly.
What? That's the most dangerous thing that you can have is an explosive that don't explode.
Yeah.
It's dangerous. And another point, the plane that they said a plane hit the Pentagon, no commercial jet is going to fly at that speed and at that elevation and have enough air under its wings to prevent it from hitting the ground. A commercial jet has to have air underneath its wings in order for it to maintain some sort of altitude. It's not unusual for a jet to flop up and down at least 100 feet, even flying under normal conditions.
Well, planes can hit it. Planes can hit it. Kamikazes were flying into moving ships during World War II.
That was
so kamikazes. It's not like it's impossible.
We're talking about a commercial jet. You have to have air under the wings to hold it up.
Well, look at a landing, though, with an autopilot system. It lands regardless of the speed. It's like a cruise missile. It'll do what it's programmed to do. So I don't know if I entirely agree with what you're saying there about air under the wing, because most of the lift generated by the wing is from the top of the wing, like 75%.
Well, yeah,
so,
you had a lift from the top of the wing, but you got to have something underneath the wing to hold it up. And another point, too, and I lost my concentration on that, but no, it was. It's just, and you're dealing with a public that just don't know as usual. And you just had a tragedy that went down.
Well, let me ask just one other question on the wing of the airplane. What about ground effect? If you come in that close with a big airplane like that, would you not be shaken completely apart, basically? When you're in ground effect?
No, not
especially
really.
Especially when you're talking about the Pentagon, you mean?
Pentagon, yeah. The airplane coming to the Pentagon.
Well, people that aren't familiar with ground effect, these vortices are generated underneath the wing that dissipate out over the wingtip, and it creates a cushioning effect. And you experience it sometimes, well, usually you're working through ground effect on a landing, okay? Well, if an autopilot system's engaged, it will ignore the ground. I mean, it flies through it on a normal approach and landing, and in that case, it wouldn't be a factor. But if they were trying to hand fly it down low, then it would. And the other point I want to point out are the speeds that they claim these airplanes are flying at, which would be, I'll just say, around 500 knots or over 500 miles per hour. People say, no, at that altitude, and that density altitude, and the engines couldn't produce the thrust, nor could the airplane fly at those high of speeds. And those speeds were generated by the National Transportation Safety Board and the FAA. They're the ones that came out and published those speeds. And I've heard aeronautical engineers and structural engineers, some of them say it could, and some of them say it couldn't. So I don't know.
Let me ask you another question. Was ILS in use then, or was they still using VOR?
ILS was in, well, you still have VOR approaches, but primarily ILS approaches are what's used by a commercial. I mean, they have ADF and VOR approaches, but if ILS is available, that's what you use.
Well, if they was using, so how would they use ILS? And I can understand VOR tracking toward the Pentagon.
Well, they didn't. That's where you got to understand how the system works. The flight management computer, I mean, the system automatically tunes VOR stations, which are navigation stations. And they triangulate that way. They've got inertial or GPS on the airplane. And this is all integrated in this computer to provide steering and autopilot commands for the aircraft. So it isn't like an ILS localizer and glide slope to fly this thing. It's all dependent upon what's been programmed into that computer.
I am going to, unfortunately, I'm going to interrupt here for just a moment. We have 9.5 minutes left of the live broadcast. So if you are out there and you are listening, now would be a good time to call in 563-999-3485. Call in within the next 9 minutes because then we'll go into the bonus hour. But if you're just listening online, then the audio will cut off in the next 9 minutes. But if you are called into the switchboard, we can continue through the bonus hour, and we can continue this discussion. So, again, the number is 563-999-3485, and then press 1 to raise your hand, and that will let me know that you'd like to you have a question or comment. Otherwise, you can just sit back and listen. And then we do have one caller that is raising their hand and has been waiting patiently, Mike. So, Mike, I'm going to go ahead and bring you on in as well to give you a chance to ask Dan any questions or to comment. Hi, Mike. Mike, are you there?
First, I want to make a point about the 1993 bombing or bombing attempt. Okay, that was a proof of concept. So they proved that they could make an attempt on a building in 1993. Okay, so they come back, 9 years later, whatever it was, or 8 years later, you know, seven, eight years later, and do what they did. Okay, okay. So, in terms of a controlled demolition, I put it in terms of this movie called Volcano with Tommy Lee Jones, when at the end of the movie, he comes in there and says, okay, I want you to drop this building right here at this specific place, make it a dam against this lava, okay? And the guy in the movie says, well, that's a controlled demolition. That would take us months, if not weeks, if not months, to plan, and he just said, do it. So obviously, this whole thing with these remote control jets, I kind of believe what you're saying, Dan.
Yeah.
Probably was in the planning for a long time.
Okay? Right.
You stated earlier that we've had this technology since the 80s, right?
Even before that, Mike.
Yeah, so if you had this since before that, okay, fine. And then okay, we can do this, and this with it, right? We know we can fly, you know, from what we've seen with these drones, we can do these drones and all that stuff. And we have another friend that is a big drone guy, or was a big drone guy, but me and Gunslinger. But we know that we can do this stuff, and we know that. And, you know, I mean, and also, Dan, correct me if I'm wrong, wasn't there in somewhere in the story where these guys, these so-called pilots, we're having trouble with the automatic pilot thing. It was coming on and going off or whatever, or they couldn't really operate it correctly or something, you know, something to that effect where they were having trouble with the automatic pilot.
I never heard that one, Mike. I never heard that one.
That's what I understand. And if they if they were taking lessons from this thing, this company down in Florida or whatever it was, wouldn't you think that even though it's a small company, a small flight company, wouldn't you think that this company would say, okay, you got this thing called automatic pilot, if you got this and this, you know, if you got this, if you need help with something, flip on the automatic pilot and they'll help you out, you know, that type of stuff. I mean, but it just seems to me that they didn't want to use the automatic pilot and they want to control it. But again, the automatic pilot is a big thing in this thing, because once you flip that thing on, whatever's been, like you said, whatever's been put into that computer, that comes to default. Right.
As a matter of fact, there's one way to switch on auto, and that's quick. There's four ways of disconnecting it. That's turn that switch off, or there's a little button on the yoke or the control wheel. You can press that, and that disengages. If you apply a 70-pound or greater force on the controls, that'll disengage it. Or fourth, if you pull the circuit breaker on the autopilot, that'll disengage it. Once this automatic system is engaged, none of those work. It has its own electrical power supply, and it's backdoored, so they, no matter what they try to do, they can't disconnect the system.
Right.
And the other thing that, and the gun hadn't pointed this out, but the black boxes that are on these planes, right? Where are the black boxes? Where are the black, black boxes are not supposed to be able to be destroyed. You know,
well,
they're not supposed to be able to be destroyed. So where are the black boxes?
Well, supposedly there's a group out there that has obtained data from a damaged flight data recorder on American 77 that hit the Pentagon. And they've analyzed this. As a matter of fact, the guy's name is David Chandler, and he's had me on Skype share screen with one of his associates and showed me all this data about American 77, and they claim it was there. They claim that based on their flight data recorder information that it clipped the light poles the way they claim they did, and that because everybody said, no, wait a minute, there were no body parts, there were no airplane parts, the hole was too small. They claim there were airplane parts and body parts inside the Pentagon. So then there's another guy, Adam Eisenberg, who was a first responder, who was one of the first people into the Pentagon after the hit, and he said, I didn't see any of that.
Yeah.
I know both of them, and I like them, and I've seen. Go ahead.
And where's the, and also,
yeah, I'm going to bring on Suzette and Robert. They usually share the line. They've been patiently waiting as well. So sorry to interrupt, but I want to bring them on. And then I also see Daniel or Kathy. I'll bring you on after Suzette and Robert, but just want to give everybody a chance kind of one by one to bring people on to ask questions and stuff. So sorry about that.
Right.
Bringing on Suzette and Robert, you're next.
Hello, Lorianne.
Hi, Suzette.
Everybody?
How are you?
I'm doing well, thank
you. Do you have a
question
or comment for Dan?
I had a question, Dan. The supposed commercial airline that had gone to Shanksville, Pennsylvania, what are your thoughts about a plane completely disintegrating into the ground? What is the pilot saying about that?
I'll give you my own opinion based on people I've talked to and Freedom of Information Act information.
Okay.
I've been given access to. People say, hey, there were no airplane parts or body parts around that hole, okay, and it wasn't there. They're saying that plane wasn't there. There is either remotely guided someplace else or something happened to it. But I work with a man that did extensive Freedom of Information Act work. And he showed the information that the debris field for United 93 was scattered over 70 acres, which would indicate that it came apart in the air, which would indicate that perhaps it's either shot down or blown up. And a forensic pathologist examine body parts that had a DNA match with the passengers on the airplane. So that would indicate, unlike what other people say, that the plane wasn't there, that it was there. There were airplane parts. But what accounts for the smoking hole in the ground? I don't know. This is wild speculation. I don't like doing that. But maybe if it was shot down by one of our fighters, that a missile hit and it hit that, created that hole in the ground. I don't know what caused the hole in the ground, but I can just give you those facts. I personally believe United 93 was there, but 9/11 pilot whistleblowers doesn't go there. That's just my own personal opinion.
Well, I was thinking, you know, maybe because it was actually our government that reported in that report as far as saying that it went into the ground and the ground pretty much just swallowed everything up, you know, like luggage. And then I heard the story, or read about the story you're talking about as far as the debris being scattered and that it actually exploded in the air. I forget where I saw that or read that, but that made more sense as far as what happened to the plane. And then we were told to believe this other story, and they had the hazmat people there, you know, circling that hole and so forth, trying to look for debris and whatnot. And then they put a monument where that hole was. So,
right.
And that's one of the few, I mean, people talk about the Pentagon. Yes, that's suspicious, real suspicious, especially because of the camera availability or access. And then, of course, the towers and the way they came down and Building 7. But few people bring out the Shanksville, and I guess it's because nobody really knows. And those two stories, the one we think is more plausible than reasonably plausible than the plane just, you know, disintegrating into the ground. And yet, I mean, that's how far the government will go, and they'll say that's the story and that's it. No more questions. Thank you very much. Good night.
Right. And if you look at that plane's trajectory, it did make a U-turn heading towards Washington, D.C. We know that much, okay? Now, did the uninterruptible autopilot make that turn? And the other thing is, that flight departed the gate 45 minutes late. By the time it got to where it was, everything had already happened at the Twin Towers and the Pentagon, which would lead me to believe, if it was a collision between people and government or whatever, that they said, okay, terminate the mission. We can't have that airplane exist anymore. So they either shot it down or blew it up. So, again, that's wild speculation on my part, except for the part that the plane appeared to have been hijacked because it made that turn off course.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And that
that's
very remember, you know, seeing a thing with Dick Cheney basically admitting that, you know, the shoot the plane down order was given, but then he claims that it was called off because, you know, the passengers were supposedly crashed it themselves. I don't believe that for a minute. I think for, you know, all intents and purposes, it makes a hell of a lot of sense. Like you were saying, Dan, you know, by the time that plane took off, there were plenty of fighter jets in the air already. The towers had already happened. Pentagon had already happened. I don't think that that kill order, that shoot it down order was actually rescinded. I believe they went through with it. I think that's the thing that makes the most sense to me.
Yeah.
I think they could have used it to their advantage rather than trying to cover it up or not talk about it, because they could have said, yes, our fighter pilots took it down, you know, as far as it's not going to crash into another building or something like that, to that effect. I don't know. But, the whole thing is just really shady and stinks to high heaven. Thank you for taking my call.
Okay,
thank you.
Of course, Suzette. I'd like to bring on Daniel and Kathy. They were next to raise their hand, so I'm going to go ahead and bring on Daniel and Kathy. See which one we got here on the line. Hey, Daniel, Kathy, who do we got? How you doing? Are you there? Uh-oh, they just dropped. Okay, never mind. their call just dropped. Let's see. I think next up was Boyd raising his hand. Boyd from Alaska. I'm bringing you on next. Hey, Boyd, do you have a question or comment for Dan?
Yeah, in regards to the debris field on 73. You know, if they had put that airplane into a diver, it somehow got into a high angle dive. You know, that airplane would come apart in the air if nobody had taken control of it and pulled out. So, I mean, being shot down is one thing. Coming apart in the air, you know, if it was in a dive or a spin or something like that because of the fight that was going on supposedly in the cockpit, you know, nobody had a chance, you know, to pull that thing out. And yeah, the aircraft would have come disintegrated up high. And, you know, I don't know what that big hole in the ground is. Could have been the largest chunk of the fuselage that made it to the ground, you know, in that particular area.
Okay, well, with regard to that remark, I'm not an aircraft structural engineer, and I've heard arguments, especially just with the speed of being 500 knots, what would happen to the airplane. And I have talked to them before, and some of them say, yeah, the airplane could withstand that speed, and others could say they're not. So that's the best answer I can give you. I don't know. I don't know if the airplane could have come apart. So I appreciate
it. Well, obviously, with a 70-mile debris field, it did come apart. How did it come apart?
Right.
See, I mean, that's a big question. But my I would lean towards the effect that the aircraft had gotten into a dive and or a spin of some type, and it just tore itself apart. And airplanes have been known to do that on many occasions.
Well, like I said, I can't answer that question. I don't know. I'm not embarrassed to say I don't know, but I don't know.
Hey, I got another question for you. You flew P-3s,
right?
You said okay. Now I'm curious because I know that Electras have always had a propensity of throwing props.
Right.
During your career in the Navy, how many P-3s threw props?
Oh, I can't. I don't know. There's some pitch lock that prevented a runaway propeller on the aircraft. But you're causing me to go back 40 years, so I know.
I kind of grew up in an aviation family. My dad was a pilot for Pan Am for his whole career.
Uh-huh.
And we had, you know, a lot of pilot friends and stuff. And I always heard that, that the Electras themselves, which is the frame that the P-3 was built upon, you know, had a propensity to get a little yancey every once in a while and throw a prop.
Right. Exactly. That's why they had this pitch lock system on there to prevent the prop blades from going completely flat on you and cause a tremendous amount of drag on the aircraft. And that's what that system was designed for, was to prevent runaway props.
Okay. Yeah, because we had one up here in Alaska 10, 15 years ago, where the Electra threw a prop, and you know, everybody made it, but they tore a big old chunk out of the floor of the aircraft.
Wow.
But they were able to successfully get back and put it on the ground.
Yeah.
And you know,
I flew them for 10 years, and I never had any prop problems in 10 years on the airplane, but I knew other people that had, so it is a problem on the aircraft. Yeah.
Okay, well, I was just curious, you know, because the P-3 was a good aircraft, other than that one small little idiosyncrasy, you know, that the
yeah.
that the whole fleet had, you know,
yeah.
of liking to get rid of propellers in mid-flight, you know.
Yeah.
So I was just,
with that,
I was just,
we do have
I was
one
just
other,
curious.
Oh, go ahead.
You know, I was just, I was really just curious as to how many Navy aircraft P-3s had that happen to them.
Oh, I don't know that statistic. I'm sorry. I don't know that statistic.
Okay.
But thanks for calling.
Yep.
Yep. Thanks, Boyd. And you could continue to hang on. Let's see, the last person that I have raising their hand, unless anybody else in the switchboard does, we have Nathan raising his hand, so I'm going to go ahead and bring Nathan on.
Hello.
Hi, Nathan.
Hello.
How are you doing? Do you have a comment or question for Dan?
Yeah, I got basically two comments that might be a little bit off, but I remember hearing somebody on a show one time that was doing what you're doing on the issue. And they pointed out something that on the, you know, the explosions at the bottom, the demolition part of it, there was
yeah.
a small elevator group that got company that was not really big enough to handle a building like that. They had a major corporation that maintenance people taking care of the elevators. Would a smaller company gets the contract? And they believe, this was their theory, the guy that was doing this interview, his theory was you got the right people that can get on down inside the building and plant stuff.
Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry for interrupting.
Now go ahead. Say what you were going to say.
No, the security company for the World Trade Center, I believe, was Bush's brother was on the board, and they had access to the building for like 6 months prior to 9/11. And there were, as I vaguely recall, a long time ago, seeing there was a cordoned off area outside the building. And but I do know his security company did have access.
Another dot. Now here's something that might not really be related, or of interest. There was a lady, and if you type in DeborahJMSmith.com, her site comes up. She had some of the surviving family members contacted her, and she did some research and wrote an article up called 9/11 Flight 93 Disgrace. They say the guy that put together, the architect that built the memorial there on the grounds was
yeah.
Muslim, and he, if you go to Google Maps and look down at it, I don't know the religion, so, but they said, you know, with all the symbolism and the way everything is shaped, it's a Muslim memorial, you know.
Really?
And this is what her and other people's theory is, you know, once they attack, they leave their mark to, like, this is territory we own. We've taken it over type of thing.
Uh-huh.
You know, kind of like staking a flag down. We're occupying your country, that kind of thing.
Okay.
But I don't know if you got any comments to that, but I just thought of that.
Well, I had never heard that before. I'll have to look up that. What was that site again?
Deborah J. M. Smith, and she also, you can also get to it by typing in informingchristians.com.
Okay, because I had never heard of that before. I do know New York and flew out of Newark also, and the flight attendants that were killed supposedly at Shanksville were a Newark flight attendant crew. So I knew the girl that spearheaded the effort to collect the money to create that monument, and all I can say is I know she wasn't a Muslim. But that doesn't say that what you're telling me isn't true. But
she says here the architect that designed it. The architect that designed the way this thing's supposed to look, kind of like the architect that made the Vietnam Wall you know, that kind of an idea. And it was of several of the members that were on the plane, victims, their family members contacted her, and they basically hired her to research, and she got into it, and she posted something that I guess for a lot of people has been ignored, you know.
Yeah.
But I went down on Google Maps and looked at it, and then looked at other Muslim sites and stuff, and it's like, you know, there might be some dots to connect here.
Okay. Well, thank you for that.
Anyway.
I'll look at that website. I wrote it down.
Okay, thank you, sir. Thank you. I'm going to hang up and keep listening.
Okay, thank you.
Mute me,
well, don't
please.
Hang up because you won't be able to call back in.
Yeah, that's
so.
What I meant. Mute me. Shut me up.
Okay, I can mute you on my end then. Yeah, and then, of course, you can press 1 again if you want to be brought back on. But, you know, I don't like to mute people. But Nathan calls on a regular phone that apparently doesn't have a mute button on it or something. So he usually just asks us to do it ourselves. Let's see. I'm just kind of scrolling down here to see if anybody else is raising their hand yet. I do have 3 more people that are just kicking back listening. So anybody else that's already on, any further questions or comments or Dan, how are you doing? Do you need a break or anything?
No, I'm fine. Keep going. I'm fine. Let me just interject something here with regard to Muslims and where I'm located right now. I mentioned I've lived here for 14 years, and I've seen firsthand what the war on terror did to Pakistan. As a matter of fact, Pakistan did not want to engage in the war on terror. And shortly after 9/11, then Undersecretary of State Richard Armitage paid a visit to the intelligence community here in Islamabad and told Pakistan that if you don't engage in our war on terror, we will bomb you. We will bomb you back into the Stone Age. And General Musharraf, who was the leader of the country at the time, blinked and gave them not only what they wanted, but more than what they wanted. And as a consequence, over 70,000 Pakistanis died over 22 years, and they wound up having to spend $120 billion they didn't have. And I saw firsthand on the news here and otherwise what the war on terror did to this country, its people, and the economy, which is in shambles, nearing bankruptcy. And that's that, plus what's happened in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, you name it, is why my sympathies don't lie with Western powers. I know about Afghanistan and Operation Enduring Freedom based on the Pentagon hit, which I don't believe bin Laden was responsible for. And we also know about the lies we were told about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And if you look at what happened to Gaddafi in Libya, the something to do with Assad and Syria, et cetera. My sympathies, because I'm here amongst 240 million Muslims, is with them. So when I say there were no Muslim hijackers at the controls of the aircraft, I'm only saying they're being blamed for 3 pilots that supposedly crashed airplanes into buildings for a crime that Muslims didn't commit. And as a result, you have 2 billion Muslims being trampled worldwide, and Islamophobia running rampant. So I just want to interject that living here definitely changed my perspective on a lot of things. And I guess it was just seeing things on the news here.
Well, yeah.
Go ahead.
About ISIS and everything, I would change your perspective maybe the other way, because, you know, when they're chopping Christians' heads off, I don't think that has to do anything, you know, with Western, imperialism, you know.
Well, it depends upon what you want to believe about ISIS, okay? Because some people believe that powers were behind it, and I don't know one way or the other. But I've heard arguments that ISIS stands for Israel Special Intel. I can't remember what they used as an abbreviation, but they claim it was a combination of Israel, Saudi Arabia, and Qatar got together and backed this group of people, but I don't know. I'm not defending Muslims or Islam saying that. It's just what I've read. So the jury's still out for me regarding ISIS and what happened about the head chopping, et cetera.
That stuff about one group being more evil than the other. Hell, King Leopold chopped off kids' hands in the Congo because they didn't meet their daily ration for bringing in rubber over 10 million.
Wow.
But, you know, you're talking about the people making reference to molten metal at the bottom of the column bases in the basement. Well, that would have ran down through those openings from the floor. It would be futile to try to put explosives at the base columns. The base columns and the base girders could have probably held all the weight on the upper floors. And the upper floors, the floor structure was bar joists with lightweight concrete. So that pancake situation is just not in there.
Well,
but no, it was explosives.
Architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth, Richard Gage founded it, but they claim, based on the structure of the building, that it was structurally impossible for it to have pancaked down the way it did all the way to the surface in 11
seconds.
No, it
wouldn't, because the steel at the lower floors is heavier and heavier and heavier and heavier.
Right.
When you get down to about you get down probably the second level, the flanges on the columns probably 6 inches thick, and that's for the girders also. What up at the top, you're probably using bar joists for floor members, lightweight concrete poured on one-inch centering. It just ain't possible.
They also said
the Titanic couldn't sink. A lot of things are possible.
Let me go back real quick to cover the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry, because we're talking about controlled demolitions, et cetera. If you're not familiar with them, a group of U.S. lawyers got together with the biggest 9/11 whistleblower groups and individuals in the world and compiled 57 evidence packages that they presented to the U.S. attorney in New York several years ago with their allegations that World Trade Center buildings 1, 2, and 7 were burnt down by controlled demolition, jet aircraft impact damages, or the fuel fires. So they presented this information. It was so overwhelming. It was so compelling that it left this U.S. attorney no recourse but to announce they were going to convene a grand jury investigation. I don't know how familiar you are with grand juries, but there's a lot of them going on right now. You don't even know what happens. They're very secretive. Well, there didn't appear to be any movement for several months on this grand jury investigation because witnesses, et cetera, weren't brought in. And they inquired with the Justice Department, who said, we don't have to tell you whether it's going on, okay? So they took it to court and walked all the way up the appeals process to the Supreme Court, who last year said, we're not going to hear your case. So this is an example, yet another time, of the government stonewalling an organization. And I've seen, you can go to their website, it's Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry. If you just Google that, you can find it. And go on there and look at evidence and their evidence packages, and it's overwhelming. I mean, they've got firefighters that reported explosions being heard, people harmed, and architects, engineers, scientists, you name it. They've all provided testimony, including William Rodriguez, who I was talking about, the janitor. So the evidence is all there. It's overwhelming. But the U.S. judicial system won't even touch it. What's that tell you? This is the greatest crime ever committed on American soil in its history, and there's never been a criminal investigation into it. The 9/11 Commission did not constitute a formal criminal investigation. So you look at the two co-chairmen of the 9/11 Commission, Tom Keene and Lee Hamilton, okay? And they wrote a book after 9/11. It wasn't publicized for obvious reasons. It's called The Inside Story of the 9/11 Commission. It wasn't widely distributed either. It was Without Precedence was the title, and the subtitle was The Inside Story of the 9/11 Commission. And they admitted that it was overfunded, time-constrained, and set up to fail. The 9/11 Commission was a farce. There's never been a criminal investigation. And anybody such as our group or the Lawyers Committee or the Architects and Engineers who tries to bring forth their case is squashed. You can't get anywhere.
So what happens if the truth comes?
I mean,
just say, for instance, like, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
I was going to ask, you know, the truth comes out, right, and you get to be heard. I mean, what's going to happen? I mean, what could be reversed? Like you said, you're seeking justice for 2 billion Muslims. I mean, what's justice then? What, in your mind, what would be justice? You know, you know what I mean?
Well, it isn't just 2 billion Muslims. It's 8 billion people on the planet that deserve to know the truth about 9/11. Because when you look at 9/11, it ushered in the fascist police state you're all living in over there with the NSA, illegal wiretaps, Homeland Security, and the Patriot Act. So that was another reason they wanted it, because I personally believe 9/11 in part was brought in to usher in the New World Order, okay, to usher in those things to quiet the American public, because right now Americans are afraid to speak out on this. They're afraid with the FBI Joint Terrorist Task Force that some FBI SWAT team will kick the front door down, take their hard drive off the computer, and throw them in a FEMA camp. Now, that may sound extreme, but people are afraid to talk out. So there's people like architects, lawyers, myself, and others who are trying to talk out to bring all this to public life. As far as the Muslim community goes, we're carrying it further than what I just said about trying to initiate an investigation. But I'm not at liberty right now to talk about who we're talking to or what we're planning on doing.
Well, the architects and the engineers are not going to talk about it because they lose their license. That's the way that goes with that. And the 9/11 Commission is about as legit as the January 6th Commission.
Exactly. Exactly.
I was wondering... I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, you go ahead.
I was just wondering if your group has had any luck in speaking to any of the survivors in either tower that had come down, or in because there were actual survivors that made it down the stairs and out the doors, but I've never heard any from any of them as far as any type of interview or anything else. And I believe the 9/11 Commission did not allow them to testify as well as far as their experience. So I was just wondering if your group was able to find them or to talk to them.
No, we weren't. I told you that I interviewed Ray McGinnis, the guy that wrote the book Unanswered Questions, okay?
Mm-hmm.
He was working with a smaller group of the next of kin. And I said, offered to him, I go, please have them contact us. And I gave our contact information. I said, because we'd like to jump on their bandwagon, but he never bothered doing it. So I know the Lawyers Committee is working with a certain group of the next of kin, but this is the tragedy. After 9/11, the next of kin were filing all kind of lawsuits, and the government worked out an out-of-court settlement with so many of the next of kin paying millions out, that and with the stipulation that they never tried to take the government to court again. I just had somebody on Twitter ask me this question. Why don't the next of kin sue them? Well, they can. Maybe there's a small group of them that could, but ask me how much trust I have in the U.S. judicial system. So,
I'm the survivors, like, actually, that were in the building itself as the plane had hit, and that had actually made it down the stairwell and out the doors. They were, you know, fortunate enough to do that.
I know William. I know William Rodriguez, the janitor in the basement. I've talked to him before, but there's no need for me to bring him up other than on programs like this, because he's already made a spectacle of himself. He told me that when he goes on these world tours, the FBI is asking about him down in the lobby of the hotels he's staying at. So they were watching him real close with what he's saying. As far as I don't know of anyone that survived it by running out of the building. Other than him.
Try contact the Hague?
There was something like 53 between the two buildings that had actually made it out, that were in the building when the impact of the planes or whatever it was that hit it, those buildings. And they were on the lower floors. So they were below where the thing had supposedly hit. So.
Well, if anybody listening to this, go ahead. I'm sorry. Keep
going. Go ahead. No, I'm done. No, please. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, if anybody knows of any of these individuals, have them contact us, or please you contact me and give me their contact information via our website or Twitter or Facebook, and we'll try to get a hold of them to do just that.
Hey, thank
well,
you.
What about Building 7?
Okay, let's talk about Building 7. Building 7...
They say that the falling of the towers weakened the bedrock that caused Building 7 to collapse. My question is, buildings between Building 7 and the towers, why come they didn't go sinking down the ground too because of a weakening of the bedrock?
I never heard that one, but look at this fact. Never in the history of steel-reinforced concrete buildings have any ever collapsed due to an office fire, and 9/11, the United States government claims that 3 did. So go figure. If you look at people that aren't familiar with Building 7, it was a 47-story foot tower that at 5:20 in the afternoon on 9/11 collapsed in its own footprint in less than 7 seconds, falling at near the free-fall acceleration due to gravity. Now, there's a study that was done by the University of Alaska, the Professor Halsey there, and it was a 4-year study that they conducted on the World Trade Center Building 7, because World Trade Center Building 7 came down by controlled demolition, and necessarily follows that the Twin Towers did too. And what they did was using computer model simulation. They were able to prove that 44 structural beams, supporting beams, fell almost simultaneously, which would be impossible except for a controlled demolition. And yet, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, which is part of the U.S. Department of Commerce, issued their statement saying it was due to a few office fires located in the corner of the building that brought the building down. And guess who the government sides with? NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology. So that was part of the lawyers' committee's case. That was part of their evidence, was Professor Halsey's report, which you can look up online. It's kind of detailed, but...
Well, you know, when structured steel is heated, it goes through a process that's called yield, Y-I-E-L-D. And it would sag, but it's not going to pull away from its end connections. It's not going to happen. And just look, you've had some structural steel buildings that burned overnight. I believe one in Brazil and another someplace else. When the sun rose the next day, the skeletal frame was still standing.
Yep. There are several examples of high-rise fires that the building was still standing, and the U.S. government and the Department of Commerce, National Institute of Standards and Technology, chooses to ignore this yet again, another stonewall. So I'm convinced, especially in the U.S. justice system, that we're not going to get justice. That's why we've got to go outside the United States to try to find some country. But if you look at it, there's 193 countries in the world. And with the exception of a handful of world leaders, none have spoken out. You had, I mentioned, Kamala in Malaysia, Ahmadinejad in Iran, Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, and there was a Francesco, whose name I can't remember, president of Italy, who came right out and said, yeah, it was an inside job through collusion between the CIA and Mossad and other intelligence. But those are the only few four that spoke out, and you have to say, why? These other world leaders can't be stupid. We've all gotten this information ourselves. Why don't they say something? Look at the terrible turmoil that we are in the world today because of 9/11 still 22 years later. And the reason is because the World Bank and the IMF has such a stranglehold on so many third world and other countries in the world, they dare not speak out. And then you've got people like Saddam Hussein, who they killed for weapons of mass destruction, but in reality, he was going to go to another currency besides the petrodollar. And you go to Gaddafi in Libya, who was going to go to the gold standard, and they whacked them both. So these leaders aren't stupid in that regard either. They know that they're either going to bring their country down financially or kill them. So everybody remains silent. So until you get a commission or a committee, and I believe it has to be outside the United States, that bands together and says, let's review the evidence, let's review the witness testimony, and publish a paper, nothing's going to happen. And that's exactly what 9/11 pilot whistleblowers are trying to do right now. We're petitioning foreign countries to say, look, they can take you on individually, but they can't take on 57 countries.
Yeah, well, I don't think Shabazz and Saddam Hussein and Gaddafi are exactly examples of freedom fighters. Yeah, I don't know if I'd be lying on them.
I won't argue that they were dictators. I won't argue that. But give me the reason why Gaddafi was...
Well, he committed lots of heinous crimes over the years to his people. I mean, he was a brutal dictator. I mean, Saddam Hussein also was not exactly Mr. Innocent. I mean, the things that the Ba'ath Party, the horrendous crimes they committed against their own people. I mean, I mean, even the chemical weapons they used against the Kurds. I mean, it was disgusting.
But
United States committed tremendous crimes against his people. You have people calling in on here.
We're not talking about
the
United States.
The
we're not talking. We're talking about Shabazz. We're talking about Hugo Shabazz, Saddam Hussein, and Gaddafi.
The United States does the same thing. You have people call in talking about chemtrails, and there's quite a lot of evidence of chemical biological tests been done on population. St. Louis, which I know very well.
Nobody said the United States isn't corrupt. Nobody said that, but we're not talking about that. I was giving reference to the three examples, and he agreed with me. They're just brutal dictators, and I wouldn't trust a word they say.
Right, but where do you draw the line regarding sovereignty of nations? United States and the West have the right to come in unimpeded while the United Nations turns a blind eye regarding the sovereignty of nations and attack a country, even though they may have been brutal dictators. They were legitimate rulers of a sovereign country, and they invaded them, in particular Iraq, based on a lie, overthrew Saddam Hussein, totally decimated the entire country, and it still is today, as is Libya. Where do you draw the line there?
Yeah,
go ahead. You got people in Libya that swear by Gaddafi.
Oh, in their mind, he was a great leader.
Yes, he was. Provided bought homes for newlyweds, free education, and so on.
Sure.
U.S. sentiment first to be killed. And the whole Benghazi thing messed up with the ambassador and all, and the weapons, you know, that we're sending to these so-called freedom fighters that actually weren't freedom fighters. But anyway, but that's all connected. I mean, all this stuff goes back, you know, and so it wasn't actually the people of Libya, because now they're enslaved. Now they have, you know, basically not a government, but worse than what they had been portrayed as by media as far as Gaddafi goes.
Well, I may sound like I'm bashing the United States, like I hate America, and I don't. Okay, I consider myself a patriot, although I'm a disenfranchised whistleblower. Okay, I'm a patriot, and what I think I'm doing, our motto for our organization is patriotism and freedom of speech and action, and that's what we believe we're doing. The horrible crime been committed, haven't been investigated, that's what we're trying to push. And in the process of doing that, you discover that perhaps your own country, some elements of the country, may have been involved in the planning and execution of 9/11. And you have to look no further than the Project for a New American Century and what claims they were making were. One year before 9/11, they were pleading for, they said there was a need for a new Pearl Harbor to happen to garner public support for increased military spending for future wars. So 1 year after that, they got their 9/11, I mean their new Pearl Harbor. And if you can go back to... Go ahead.
The lady that was running for president for India, I can't think of her name, Bhusa Lazy, she said that... what's his name? Said he had been dead.
Yeah, what?
The one that who was talking about him earlier? I can't think of his name now. That Obama and them supposed to, Phil Team Six supposed to took out. What was his name?
Bin Laden.
Bin Laden. Yeah, she said Bin Laden had been dead.
Oh yeah.
And then. Yeah, you remember her?
Yes, the former president and prime minister of Pakistan, Benazir Bhutto, being interviewed, and she said he had been dead. There's arguments that he died in December 2001 due to kidney failure. Some people say he lived another 5 years, but the fact of the matter is true. He was on dialysis machine, suffering from kidney failure. I have a good friend over here. He was a 42-year physics professor at the University of Punjab, which is a big university over here. His name is Dr. Mujahid Kamran, okay? Besides a 42-year physics professor, he was chairing that department for years. In his last 8 years, he was the longest-standing vice chancellor of the university, a very prominent figure over here. But he had written 16 books, and one of them was 9/11 and the New World Order. And I use Mujahid as my mentor and my confidant over here when I discuss political issues or issues relating to Islam or otherwise, like the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. He gave me that idea. But what he did was he went on national TV over here and basically said, hey, the world doesn't operate the way we think. There's this New World Order group, like what I just mentioned, is really running the show. And he intimated that 9/11 was an inside job. And they drummed up bogus charges on him, not only fired him, but threw him in jail. But the public outcry was so loud they had to release him. But he saw a court case hanging over his head. You cannot speak out about 9/11 without expecting repercussions unless you protect yourself somehow. So that's an example. And some people say to me, well, right after Benazir Bhutto made that mistake, she was assassinated. Well, that is true, but I don't know if the two are related because I live over
So Bin Laden was dead? Is that what the Piantis? I mean, you guys are saying Bin Laden was already dead? That's operation in Pakistan?
That's what she said, yes.
So 36 Navy SEALs are going to lie?
There's another speculation on that as well, that he died long before. And some of those videos, like particularly the video that where he supposedly finally admits to being behind 9/11, which was like 2 years later, that he supposedly did this video. And there's been a lot of scrutiny about that video going, that's not him, you know. There was a series of videos that Bin Laden supposedly put out, and a lot of people went in and scrutinized them, and they're like, no, that's not him. Therefore, that kind of leads us to believe that, yeah, he was already dead. That was kept quiet in order to keep the war going, because, you know, so long as he was still alive, then we still had the justification for being there, right? So, yeah, there's a lot of that going on. I remember watching a lot of breakdowns of the videos that he supposedly did and comparing them, you know, and they're like, no, this is like a duplicate. This is a, you know, this is like a doppelganger kind of thing, an actor doing these videos.
Right. Well, then you can also look it up. Go ahead.
Well, that's the same thing we say about Joe Biden. Was that him that done the State of the Union? speech here 2 weeks ago? I mean, think. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to go back to Afghanistan and bin Laden, because if you look, Operation Enduring Freedom was launched because the Pentagon attacked the act of war and launched this coalition of the willing into Afghanistan within weeks after 9/11. Well, Operation